Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have to make a start. Professor Kevin Featherston cannot make it right now, so we have to really start the session. This session, we are going to, we've got two distinguished guests, Fiona Malin and Costantino Stefanou, who are going to talk about the business sector and the banking sector. As you must have heard, the banking sector is highly concentrated and forms a huge proportion of the GDP of the economy in Cyprus, and it also has a huge exposure to the Greek government debt. But as rightly Moritz Kramer pointed out earlier on in the morning session, the Greek banks, the Cypriot banks, are not only exposed to the Greek government debt, they are also a huge proportion of their loan portfolio has to do with the Greek private and public sector. So the Greek exposure is really much bigger than we think. And according to some Standard & Poor's, they form about 168% of GDP, the total exposure to the Greek economy. So they do form a systemic risk, and I'm sure Costantinos is going to talk about and what sort of rules and regulations we have to impose in order to avoid this possibility of a risk. Costantinos is, Stefanou is a senior economist at the World Bank, and he has written extensively on financial system, especially of small economies, and he's very well familiar with the Cyprus banking system, so I think he's going to give us some good advice as to what we should do. Costantinos. We have, each one of them will have about 20 minutes of talk, and then there will be a Q&A session, so you will have plenty of time to ask a lot of questions.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot, Kate. And let me also thank the organizers for inviting me to this event. I'm glad to be here. It's probably also a good idea that my presentation takes place after lunch, because I don't want to cause you indigestion. But we'll see how it goes. My PowerPoint presentation is based on a paper I've written last year with a catchy title of Big Banks in Small Countries, the Case of Cyprus. And it's just a few slides. I will try to go through them relatively quickly. The idea is to trigger discussion, raise some issues, not necessarily provide solutions. We can talk a little bit more about potential solutions afterwards in the Q&A. And let me also point out that the usual disclaimer applies. These are my own personal views and not necessarily the views of the World Bank or the institution I currently work on with right now, which is the Financial Stability Board in Switzerland. Two main sections. The first one, by way of background, the characteristics of the banking sector. Just to give you a little bit of more insights as to how that sector looks like and how it's evolved over the years. And then the second is to talk about two separate but related issues, which are the current vulnerabilities in the system and the recapitalization needs that are associated with them, and the issue of systemically important banks. And unfortunately, the gentleman from Standard & Poor's stole my thunder on both of those issues. I'll go into more depth. I will provide some more details on them. But I think my sections are not going to be that different. The main messages are not going to be that different from what we've already been told. There exist other issues as well that are relevant for the banking sector. What to do about the cooperative sector, that's a piece of the banking sector overall, the regulatory structure, etc. Those were issues that were particularly relevant prior to the crisis, but now have taken secondary importance. They're not as relevant anymore, and I think the main issues right now are those two. So let's talk a bit about the characteristics of the banking sector in Cyprus. It's a huge, by international comparisons, and you'll see fairly, I'll show some graphs later, but it's a very large sector compared to the economy. It's been historically successful. It's made up of three pillars. Domestically owned banks, And there we essentially talking about the big three, or the big two plus Hellenic. So Bank of Cyprus, Marfin Popular, and Hellenic, and a few other small ones. Foreign bank branches or subsidiaries, most of those are Greek. You probably know them very well, Alpha, National Bank, Eurobank, Piraeus, etc. And cooperatives. The cooperatives represent about a little bit more than 20% of the system. The system is characterized by a relatively high degree of concentration. The top three banks account for a good chunk of the deposits and the loans. Those ratios are even larger if you just focus on the domestic loans and deposits and take out the loans and deposits related to offshore entities. And it's very much still a traditional banking business model. And what do we mean by traditional? We mean high reliance on deposits, a loan-driven model. You basically make your money off the spread. And there's minimal trading activities and or other kinds of structure or investment banking activities in the domestic banks. So it is very much a traditional model. Having said that, it's true that the banks are organized as under the universal banking model that's very common in Europe. So you have they offer a wide range of financial services. The bank sits at the top, and under the bank sit the insurance subsidiary, the stock brokerage subsidiary, the leasing subsidiary, etc. The banking sector, it is fair to say that the banking sector made a significant contribution to the development of Cyprus as an international business center. It is responsible to a large degree for intermediating the financial flows of that are associated with the business center and with the registration of offshore companies, etc. So, graph number one. Banking sector size for selected countries. This data goes back to the end of 2009, unfortunately. I was hoping that the European Central Bank would update its publications. I guess they have more urgent things to do nowadays. But the picture hasn't changed much. The total assets of the Cyprus banking sector correspond to around 9 times the country's economy, 9 times GDP. Now, 2 times GDP is made up of the foreign operations of the domestic banks. So the operations in Greece, in Russia, and in other places, those are 2 times GDP. If you take them out, the domestic system is 7 times GDP. That's a very big number in comparative terms. So, for example, to give you an idea, in the case of the European Union, the average is around 3.5 times GDP. So Cyprus is more than twice, the Cyprus banking sector is more than twice the size of the economy compared to the EU average. And I've put in a few other countries just to give you a sense of comparison. Luxembourg is an outlier. Luxembourg, for various reasons, because it's an international financial center, because it's small and has a big neighbors, German banks, German, French, Belgian banks that have subsidiaries there, stands out from the rest. But if you take out Luxembourg, Cyprus is probably the second in the European Union in terms of size of the banking sector, in terms of the domestic economy. Ireland and Malta have a fairly similar structure, and pretty much everybody else has a smaller size. Now, so size is the one distinguishing factor here. The second is a composition. As you can see, domestic credit institutions, that is the domestic big three banks, a few smaller domestic banks, and the cooperatives, account for a very big chunk of the sector. This is very different than the case of Luxembourg, for example, where you might have banking sector as 20-odd times GDP, but most of it belongs to foreigners. It's German banks, it's Belgian banks, it's French banks. In the case of Cyprus, we have two big banks, two very big banks, and I'm going to get to the systemic risk issues associated with them a little bit later. Now, the banking sector has grown quite a bit in the last few years, especially since entry into the European Union in 2004. I'm not sure how easy it is to see, but it essentially more than doubled in the space of about 4 years, 4 or 5 years, a very rapid pace of growth. It wasn't the only banking sector that grew rapidly. A number of other countries, as you can see from the graph, grew at around the same time, driven by the favorable global macroeconomic conditions, abundant liquidity, the desire of their national governments to develop those banking sectors as financial centers, etc. But it is quite remarkable how that sector has grown in the last few years and become so important. These are two metrics that can be used to indicate the importance of the sector to the economy, either in terms of value added or in terms of employment. Of course, those two are only are metrics indicating the direct contribution. There's a lot of indirect contribution coming in through the use of lawyers, accountants, and a whole business sector that Fiona is going to talk to us about a bit later on. So have no doubt about it, this is a very important sector for Cyprus. Now, this was the good part of the story. Let's get to the uglier part of the story, the issues for discussion. The first of the two issues, the current vulnerabilities, and those very much reflect what rating agencies, international organizations like the IMF, and others have been saying for the last few years. A very big one is exposure to Greece. Exposure to Greece is around 28 billion for the Cypriot banks. Most of the exposure lies in the two big banks. Five of that is government bonds, 23 of that is loans. So everybody focuses on government bonds, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more exposure than just the 5 billion that everybody talks about that will be subject to the so-called PSI, the private sector involvement, currently being discussed. In addition, not many people talk about, which is that the Greek banks are active in Cyprus and they have subsidiaries. And those subsidiaries take deposits from Cypriot residents and give loans to Cypriot residents. So those Greek banks represent more than 10% of the domestic banking sector, whether you look at it in terms of deposits or loans. And that's something else to consider. Problems in the banking sector in Greece being channeled or transmitted via the subsidiaries of those banks in Cyprus. The second item, and this goes back to the issue of whether is it just Greece that's a problem, or is it more? And I think it's more. I think that there are some problems domestically. The real estate and construction sector have not been doing particularly well in the last couple of years. Property prices have been going down fairly slowly. However, we don't know what the bottom is yet. And a lot of the lending of the banks, especially in recent years, has been in the terms of property development and mortgages. And I'm not talking about commercial banks, I'm also talking about the cooperatives. The third and related vulnerability is a dependence of the system on non-resident deposits. Those non-resident deposits are associated with a lot of the companies that come and register in Cyprus, the offshore companies. So they are corporate, they are transactional in nature, they tend to be short-term, and therefore they can be subject to rent. That's one of the reasons why the very prudent liquidity ratio that the central bank currently has been applying historically has been a very, very effective tool to reassure the market participants that there is liquidity in the banks. And finally, and this is something that you all know, there are very clear links between the sovereign rating, and the banks, the two big banks. Why? Because the rating agencies consider the two big banks to be systemically important, and therefore that the government will come in and support them in case of problems. So the problems of the banks get reflected on the rating of the sovereign. Sovereign gets downgraded, then the banks get downgraded, and it becomes a vicious circle. I will come to that in just a while. Of course, the problems with the sovereign downgrades don't have to do just with the banks. That has to be very clear. It has to do also with the whole macroeconomic management, and that has been taking place in the last few years. The other major issue there is that the two big banks participated in the European Union stress test last year for the second time, and subsequently to that, a decision was made by the European Banking Authority that all banks participating in those tests should have a minimum core equity Tier 1 capital ratio of 9%, which meant that in the case of the two big banks, there is a hole, a gap of about 3.6 billion that needs to be raised. Now, strictly speaking, banks don't necessarily need to align themselves to that capital ratio via new equity, or so only via new equity. They can shed assets, they can sell businesses, they can deleverage, they can do a number of other different things. The problem is that this requirement has been imposed around September last year and has a timetable, a deadline of June, which means that there's a tremendous pressure nowadays on the banks to do something and find ways to recapitalize themselves. So everybody hopes, and not least the government, that they will be able to do that without government support. We will see. The second but related issue is that the two big banks are systemically important. The place where I currently work, the Financial Stability Board in Basel, Switzerland, has been doing a lot of work for the G20 on the definition of systemic risk and what policy measures to introduce for systemically important financial institutions. The various kinds of criteria we use to identify systemically important financial institutions include things such as the size of the institution compared to, in absolute terms, or compared to the domestic economy, the degree of interconnectedness of the institution to the rest of the financial system, whether the kinds of services that the institution provides are substitutable or not. So if it goes down, whether somebody else will step in and provide those services, the complexity in the operations, the leverage that exists, etc. So it's my own personal opinion, but based on the metrics that for those banks and those criteria, the two big banks are systemically important. They have a very large size compared to the economy, as we already discussed. They have a dominant domestic presence in virtually every single financial segment, and they tend to dominate it. They typically are the number one or number two or number three player in whether you look at it in funds management, leasing, insurance, factoring, stock brokerage, corporate lending, etc. Of course, systemically important doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to fail. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that the collapse of one of them, however unlikely, could disrupt the flow of financial services and have negative spillover effects. I mean, that's something that to be made clear. There exist mitigating factors. The two big banks have a strong domestic franchises. As we said, there's a traditional business model. The prudential framework of the Central Bank of Cyprus, for the most part, is quite conservative, and for good reasons. There's a number of examples to show how conservative that framework is. I mentioned already the liquidity ratio that's applicable for non-resident deposits. There's a conservative definition of regulatory capital. They have loan-to-value limits for mortgage lending. So for all, there exist mitigating factors, but the issue is, and it remains, what happens if those banks get into problems? Because having systemically important banks introduces the so-called too-big-to-fail problem. Are the banks too big to fail? And as we've seen in the case of Iceland, are they too big to save in the event of a problem? So there's lots of lessons from the crisis, and what happened in other countries with major financial centers that the authorities should and could reflect on. And just to mention a few names, what happened in the United Kingdom here, what happened in Ireland, in Iceland, in Switzerland, in the Netherlands. In a number of these countries, the financial sector got into problem, and those financial sectors had systemically important institutions. They had to be saved, and so the question becomes, how can they be saved? Should they be saved? If they're not saved, what happens to the real economy? This figure gives you a sense of how big those institutions are in comparative terms. I took the biggest one or two banks for each country, or at least for some of the European countries, took their assets, the assets of the bank, the balance sheet size, divided it by the home country GDP. So if we're talking about Barclays on the right-hand side, I took the total assets of Barclays divided by the UK's GDP to come up with a ratio to indicate the relative size and importance of that bank compared to the domestic economy. Why am I using this ratio? I'm using this ratio because in the event that such a bank would get into problems, it is quite likely that the state would have to come in and support it. As you can see from the left-hand side, both of the two big banks are huge compared to almost every other bank in the universe of big European banks, compared to the domestic economy. People talk about J.P. Morgan or Bank of America as humongous banks. They are humongous banks, but they are only about 15 or 20% of the size of the U.S. economy. They're not 250%. So let me conclude with this, having scared you enough, or hopefully generated ideas for discussion. Let me provide some concluding thoughts, which essentially summarize the presentation. I think the banking sector has served Cyprus very well to date. And the question really going forward is whether that growth can continue indefinitely and at what cost. Systemic risks are important in Cyprus given the sector's size and structure. So it's not just that the sector is very big, it's that the sector is structured so that we have very big institutions within it. And not only that, but those big institutions are owned by us and not by some big foreign bank. So we are on the hook to save them if there's a problem. So the experience of other countries there will be very useful in this context. And in the paper that I've written last year, I've suggested a number of things that the authorities should consider. A more macroprudential approach to financial sector oversight, strengthening of prudential regulation and supervision even more, very strong macroeconomic fundamentals, and the ability to have to react in case of problems, which means that you have to have the so-called fiscal space. If you want to play in this game, and if you look at the experience of places like Singapore or Hong Kong, you need to have very low public debt to GDP. If you don't have very low public debt to GDP, you're exposed to whatever problems those banks create for you. So either you sell those banks to the foreigners and let them worry about it, hopefully, or you work, you make sure that your economy operates at levels of public debt that can support the economy in case one of them has problems. So the final bullet point, and it's a thought, maybe a more positive thought, is that the crisis provides an opportunity, not only the need, but also an opportunity to rethink the business model for the sector. Is this what we want? What would be a sustainable longer-term solution for the banking sector? Do we want to have these two big banks or the current structure? Or if not, how do we go about changing it? This is not just a technocratic issue to be left to the hands of the authorities or the central bank. It involves very difficult policy trade-offs because it carries implications about the way that Cyprus has grown in recent years, the dependence on the international business sector. How much is the business sector dependent on having big banks? Should those banks be restructured as in the case, along the lines of what is proposed, for example, in the UK, the so-called Vickers Commission, where we split the part that we want to save and the rest of the part can do whatever it wants? How do we go about thinking those changes? And so one idea that I had included in the paper is whether there's a need to set up some kind of commission of experts or thinking group to rethink these issues and bring in the various stakeholders, because there are many in this case. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sure there will be plenty of questions, but I think if we give this talk to Fiona Mullen, director of Sapienta, who has also very good experience about the business sector in Cyprus, and in fact she has lived in Cyprus for 10 years, so she has already a very, very nice feeling. So please, Fiona.
Minister, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity to talk today. I picked this topic because it's specifically about business services, meaning professional services, accounting and legal services. And it's a sector which I'll demonstrate in a moment is of increasing importance in Cyprus, but it's not generally acknowledged. People still seem to think that tourism is what keeps the economy going. But it faces a number of risks, which I'll talk about in a moment. And it's also would have been a topic for... we think we've been rejected because we didn't tick the right number of boxes or something, but with another potential research partner who would have looked at the micro side, the innovation and entrepreneurship side of this sector, Marina Seadotu. We're looking for someone to sponsor us to look into this a bit further. So, as I said, which is the bigger sector now? Is it tourism or is it the suits, as I call them? You can see that back in 2001, which was the peak of tourism arrivals, tourism in terms of balance of payments inflows accounted for just over 20% of GDP, and other business services, which is accounting, legal and something called merchanting services, which I'll explain if anybody needs to, was only about 9.5% of GDP. Nearly 10 years later, tourism is less than 10% of GDP and was overtaken at least in 2010, maybe not in 2011 because we had a good tourism year, by this what's called in the balance of payments other business services. And you can see the trend, how it's been happening. Essentially, a general decline in tourism revenue, but quite a sharp pickup, especially after EU entry and then Eurozone entry for the other business services sector. And once you add financial services, which, was explained, is a key part of why we get this business, it's considerably larger now than tourism. It's about 15% of GDP. looking at it, that was the balance of payments side. Looking at it in terms of national accounts, it doesn't specifically give just the other business services, but since we know that science and technology is pretty small in Cyprus, this 4.5%, the little pie at the top there, is probably its total gross value added as a percentage of GDP. So it's not as big as, for example, finance and insurance, which is 7.3%, but I think it will continue to grow. Also, the labour force has been growing in both of these sectors, the professional and the finance and insurance, whereas you can see things have been a lot more volatile for accommodation and food services, which is generally the one most influenced by tourism. I'd even say you can see the growth here hasn't been as fast as it has been for things like construction and so on, so possibly the labour force is more efficient in this sector than it is in the more traditional sectors. A caveat to that, though, is I had a look at the worker to sectoral gross value added. So, for example, if you take the number of employees in the finance and insurance sector as a proportion of the gross value added, it's quite low in finance and insurance. So despite the fact that it's common for us to say, oh, there are too many, we're overbanked, there's too many bankers, relative to the other sectors, the banking system seems to be doing better. You see from the previous slide as well, financial intermediation was the one at the bottom of that list, of that chart. But the professional services sector doesn't necessarily do that much better than the traditional tourism sector, and it's a little bit higher in terms of how many people it employs per, if you like, unit of output compared with the total economy. And that's why I'm not the... the Minister wasn't the only one who forgot a slide today. There was going to be another slide which I prepared about the real effective exchange rate of Cyprus, something I looked at in a book I co-edited with James last year. If you look at the real effective exchange rate adjusted for labour costs, Cyprus is up there with the pigs. You know, Germany's has fallen over the years, and Cyprus has gone up with Portugal, Spain, and Italy and Ireland. Not so much Greece, but they had other problems. So, of course, you can't just strip out the services from there, but we do have a competitiveness problem, which people were talking about this morning. Obviously, we have a lot of strengths. All the accountants, I spoke to some accountants before in preparation for this speech, they all say that joining the EU was the best marketing tool that they were ever given. They can just go out and say, we're a member of the EU now, we're in the Eurozone, and so that's a sort of natural badge of honour, as it were. Clearly, we have an educated labour force, which helps with the particular kind of services. Finally, got ourselves off the, not quite yet, the Russian blacklist, but I think it's coming, but the OECD, we actually not only got off the blacklist in 2002, I think it was, but now specifically on a whitelist. A legal system which is similar to the UK one, so that attracts a lot of companies familiar with that system. And for the time being, I'll talk about what I'm saying for the time being, a favourable tax system. So the real question is, so clearly it's an important sector, as I say, probably more important now than tourism, and how long can this last? I think the main risks, of course, one of the risks that I haven't put on here is the banking sector, but I knew somebody else would be talking about that, so... But clearly that's one of the biggest risks at the moment, and certainly worrying the people I spoke to. The other risks, and I'll explain what these risks are in a moment, is certain government policies, EU policies, the Russians and the Maltese, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. I think one of... this is a former finance minister, but I think internally, those of us who live in Cyprus knew that he'd never really meant to raise the corporate tax rate to 11%. It was just a sort of a ruse to get other measures through. But but as a message to the external world to say we're going to get rid of what is our best marketing tool, namely the lowest tax rate in the EU, was a very, very big mistake. Companies that come to Cyprus, they want a stable tax system, and so messing around like that was not clever in the current environment. And of course, as a result of having to cut the budget deficit and so on, at least the corporate tax rate has stayed at 10%, but other business and income taxes have been on the rise. Not so much for non-resident companies, but still there are a lot of foreign resident companies in Cyprus. And of course, the downgrades by the rating agencies suggest that there is a loss of confidence in whether or not Cyprus can really get itself out of this fiscal and financial hole. Maybe Polis will correct me if I'm wrong here. Maybe it's the Germans, actually, who want to... one of the risks for one of our strengths is that, of course, there are pressures to either harmonise the tax rate or the tax base, which might remove some of the key advantages. One of the key advantages of the Cypriot tax system is that there's no tax on... there's no withholding tax on non-resident companies, which apparently is a very attractive feature of the tax system. The accountants I spoke to, it was not really clear, actually, would this affect. The general assumption was it wouldn't actually. Even if there were a harmonised tax base, perhaps it wouldn't affect this withholding tax. But I think the general message is there's uncertainty about how long can we keep a low tax rate. And one of the consequences that was mentioned, for example, would be if the tax base is measured on the basis of the assets of the company. You've got a lot of foreign companies in Cyprus whose assets are actually elsewhere. Now, there could be an opportunity. It could persuade them to move their assets to Cyprus. But it could also be a risk if they end up having to really base themselves in the, let's say, Germany or whatever. So. The Russians is really, this is all about a risk of overdependence. You know, we got overdependent on British tourists and we paid a high price for that. And we're in danger of getting overdependent on Russians in terms of their impact on the business sector as well. These are unofficial estimates, but from a, let's say, a very reliable source, that Russian bank deposits are probably about 40% of all non-resident deposits. Russian tourists rose, the tourists coming into Cyprus rose by more than 50%, or around 50%, both in 2010 and 2011, which was great, you know, it helped a lot, but are we going to end up having the same dependence on Russians as we used to have on the Brits? I did a sort of calculation that probably by about 2023 or something, the Russians will overtake the British as the main tourism market. They're already the second largest. Russian business services, you'll never get a number out of an accountant, but they do say it's a significant proportion of their business, although the good news is the tendency apparently has been decreasing, so that some diversification is already taking place. But there is, you know, longer term for Russia, you keep hearing they're not investing enough in their in the future, if you like, of their natural resources. So for the time being, when the oil price is high, they can just keep pumping it out. But are they investing enough to keep it coming out of the ground is an open question. And then the Maltese. This, again, all the people I spoke to were very worried about how fast the Maltese are catching up and actually taking us over in certain cases. One of the comments was that they are, the Maltese are more risk-taking than the Cypriots. And I wonder whether it's a byproduct of the Cyprus problem, is that because the whole basis of how the Republic of Cyprus has presented itself to the world is on the basis of legality and the legal order and so on. So we sort of seem to be obeying the rules, a bit too much like the Brits in that sense, whereas the Maltese are more likely to take risks. For example, to take a risk in some sort of incentive that may or may not be accepted by the EU, but you know, you take the risk and then you have to take it away if it doesn't work. I understand that they got the gaming company sector because we were too slow in adopting legislation. Everybody's talking about how they're taking funds because we haven't passed the... I think it's going to Parliament very soon, though, isn't it? The legislation on... the new fund legislation, the use it's for, and the Alternative Investment Fund Management Directive. Okay, I'm nearly finished. And so as Marina, my would-be partner in this, said, the Maltese are eating our lunch is the best way to put it. So are we, you know, we started off as being the best business centre in the region, but now maybe we're falling behind. We're being the, as it were, friends reunited to Malta's Facebook. So finally, just to conclude, let's take the lessons from tourism. I think we got a bit too complacent. So, I know that our current minister knows very well that this is an important sector because we worked on it together in our looking how it would benefit in the event of a solution. Another good thing I found out after I'd prepared this, the Cyprus Investment Promotion Agency is very aware of the Maltese risk, and they're trying to be quite proactive about making sure, for example, this legislation goes through and so on. And finally, and this is a shameless plug for the research we would like to do, learn about innovation and so on. It's not just about the government, it's also about the individual businesses. And there's a lot of lessons about innovative practices and how they can help the sector grow. Thank you.
We have some time for questions, so we'll take questions for both speakers. Well, perhaps I can start since you are still thinking about it. I want to ask a question to Costantino. I mean, you haven't mentioned really about the Central Bank of Cyprus. Do you believe that it played a role in the current situation of that the banking system find itself? Were there any measures that the CBC could have taken in order to prevent the current situation? It seems that things are very quiet with regard to the Central Bank of Cyprus. It's unfortunate that there isn't any representative here, the bank. Yeah, if you want to answer that.
Well, it's always clear with 2020 vision, right? We know that they made mistakes. We know that the government made mistakes. We know that the banks made mistakes. I guess the issue is whether we're ever going to know the depth of the relative factors that led to those decisions being made. I mean, I have to look at the situation back. We have to go back before the crisis and look at how things were. I used to work 15 years ago for one of the two big banks in the Greek operations. And it was the growth market. That's where you would go to grow. It was the obvious market to expand. And so it is a bit difficult to go back and think with how we know now the world turned out to be and see what they should have done before the crisis. Now, maybe and probably, they should have moved faster once the crisis hit. That, I think, is one of the big lessons. Decisions typically, and this is typical in the public sector, I see it all the time, whether it's governments or central banks, they always delay. Delay in the hope that things are going to get better, and then things are forced upon them. So if we were able to have introduced stronger capital rules 2 years ago, maybe we'd have been in a better situation now. If we were able to tell the banks to hold off their horses on Greek expansion, Greek investments, Greek generally, 2 years ago, maybe the situation would have been better now. But I don't want to engage into counterfactuals. I don't know the situation. I haven't been inside, so it's difficult to make that decision outside, from the outside perspective.
But there is, I've seen a report by the IMF back in 2005, by which when the IMF came and visited Cyprus, that they were recommending to the central bank to increase its supervisory, the skilled labor employees with regard to the prudential regulations. And still, and also they were saying that they should increase the supervision with regard to the cross-border operations. So there was some warning even going back before the crisis.
There was. But 2 points to keep in mind. This is a sort of boilerplate recommendations that the IMF gives to pretty much everyone. I know because I gave them myself when I was doing financial sector assessments at the World Bank. And secondly, if you may recall, the preoccupation at the time was slightly different. As I had mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, there was a lot of discussion about the supervisory structure, whether we should merge the supervision of the central banks with the cooperatives, how to bring the cooperatives to compete with there. And the IMF, just like everybody else, never really saw the crisis. Very few people saw the crisis coming. So it's difficult to go back and say, well, yes, there was this one recommendation among 10 that you could have done something about and you haven't done enough. And it's difficult without more detailed knowledge of what happened subsequently.
What can
they do now?
Yeah, that's...
You say it's easy with hindsight.
Well, 1 year ago I would have told them, and I did tell them, we follow the two basic rules of crisis management, which is get ahead of the market and prepare for the worst. Get ahead of the market means you take measures before the market actually starts to realize that the situation could get worse, and therefore you build credibility and get prepared, get ready for the worst by doing crisis management, contingency planning, etc., etc. We're way beyond that now. We can toss those around. So now we just have to think very practically. How do we make sure that our banks raise enough capital to comply with the EBA rules? And it's a very difficult decision, because the decision may be that ultimately we might have to sell those banks to foreigners, and foreigners from outside the European Union, versus we nationalize those banks. Could be. So the government is going to have, the central bank, the government, the banks are going to have to decide. We're down to that, unfortunately, in my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think
Can I bring up this term competitiveness? We have seen a little bit about the productivity of the sectors. Fiona was explicit about this. It was rather more implicit in Constantina's presentation. But I am not aware of looking at the relative productivity of these sectors. And if the impetus is the improvement of competitiveness, what are the implications for the future of both the banking sector and the wider business services sector? Are these things actually competitive relative to something out in the rest of the world or something else out in Europe? And in fact, are these maybe rather protected or in fact over staffed sectors, which are likely, at least in terms of employment, if not in terms of value added, to contract?
I think actually, it was a surprise when I looked at that figure of the employment to gross value added ratio, but my general impression is that the business services in Cyprus are not, you know, they are competitive. You know, you don't get paid the same as an accountant in Cyprus as you do in the UK. I think you start a pretty low salary, and it's, to my knowledge, not really unionised, so it doesn't get the automatic twice yearly pay increases that some other people do. Banking, well, it's been mentioned before that they're all pretty highly paid and so on. So that, I think it's reflected in, for example, it's one of the things I looked at in the book was we pay quite a high interest rate on commercial loans in Cyprus. And that's because, partly because the banking system is partly a function of the liquidity requirement. So the banks, and because the banks are quite traditional, so they, where else do they get the money from is really only, as Constantino said, on the spread. And so I think we had higher, even this was back in middle of 2010, we even had higher commercial interest rates than Greece. And so that obviously doesn't help. Well, it raises costs for business, and if that affects competitiveness and so on. But I just wanted to say something about the hindsight thing. I have a great deal of respect for the central bank. I think they're doing the best job that they can under the circumstances. And the problem was there were really a government that didn't notice what was happening. It had its head stuck in the sand and allowed expenditure to get out of control at a time when it really should have been paying more attention. So the banks have already they've already got 9% capital ratios. And the deposit base is 60 billion, which is sort of, you know, 70 billion, three times GDP and so on. You're only allowed to lend 25% of your non-resident deposits. So there's quite a lot of regulatory things in place. The 9% should be enough, but then the EBA came along and said, no, you still need, on top of that, a capital buffer, which is not the core tier one ratio, another 3.6 billion. And that was really the kind of the knife. That, before that, I'd been writing articles saying we'll make it without a government intervention, but now, it doesn't seem to be possible. But I think it was, unfortunately, I don't want to name names, but certain individuals no longer in the government who got their eye off the ball, and therefore it was left the central bank with a big problem to deal with.
Okay, we have Edwin.
Previous governments always took the opportunistic route rather than take the hard decisions and, for example, reform the cooperatives, change the trust legislation to take advantage of opportunities, for example, recently when Bermuda was changing the rules and it could have really enticed all the funds to go in Cyprus. In fact, they all went to Ireland, not that Ireland was saved, but at least with a fantastic professional services firm that we have in Cyprus, we could have assisted. And I remember a few years ago when I was there celebrating Deloitte's 50th anniversary, 100th anniversary, we met with the then Minister of Finance and we discussed that and how could really assist in making Cyprus more competitive worldwide in this area. Of course, the Russian money came in, easy option, lots of money, and so they went for that rather than taking the hard decisions. In terms of what you said, Fiona, regarding Malta, I agree with you. Malta is really very nimble. They kind of react very quickly, unlike our government. One example, last week, they announced this new innovative way to entice non-EU nationals, EA nationals, to go to Malta, easy immigration rules, so they can actually attract people from, of course, Asia, developing countries to come to EU, which is something that I know Cyprus has introduced some rules regarding taxation of non-residents, etc., which are very positive. But I think we could do more in that area. And the one thing that you forgot to mention, of course, is that our fantastic treaty network, that is something that we always use for any structures that goes into a lot of countries, the holding company in Cyprus, because of our extension treaty network. So that continues, and I think that will still be helpful for us in the long term.
Okay, thank you very much. I think Bolivia.
No, I have a very simple question to either of you if you're familiar with the Cyprus banking system more than I am, because It seems to me that the high interest rates that they charge on both that they pay on deposits and they charge on loans, that is that it, well, it should be unsustainable, because there is a very simple way of breaking it down. I mean, they lend at something like 9% or something to businesses now. Why doesn't a British bank like Barclays or HSBC or something go into Cyprus and lend at 6 or 7% and then use their foreign deposits where they pay only 2% interest on the deposits? And that would completely undermine the banks of Cyprus, because if you ask one of the big Cyprus banks, you know, why do you lend at 9%? They say, oh, because we pay such high interest rates on deposits. Then if you say, why do you pay that? They say, because we want to offer a good service to our savers, which is complete nonsense, of course. You know, bankers don't want to have, bankers want to make money, not offer good service. but why doesn't that happen?
Well, let me take a stab at it, and then maybe Fiona can say. You have to remember that the structure of the market, the structure of the market is that they have some few. You have the cooperatives, you have a few big domestic banks, and then you have a big, you have a lot of foreign subsidiaries of mostly Greek banks. The Greek banks are desperate for deposits. They are the ones that are driving up the...
Not 3 years ago,
but since the crisis, the last 2 or 3 years.
It's been going on since Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about Jesus Christ, but... The problem is now. The problem is now. You cannot just force the banks to lend more. It's not just the issue of capital, and it's not just the rates are determined obviously by the spread. The spread is determined from the deposit rates. The deposit rate is based on how you can attract customers, because they don't really go out to markets to borrow, and nowadays they cannot even do that given the credit ratings. To compete for deposits means competing against the Greek banks. Domestic operations, and those banks are desperate for deposits as well.
I think just one issue. I mean, there were some British banks in Cyprus, Barclays, NatWest, and they left. I mean, in fact, Barclays was very well thought of in Cyprus, and it had 10% of the market, but it decided to sell the operations to the Hellenic. Yeah. And because I think they were not compete with the Greek bank, Cypriot banks, with all that huge branch network, and that's why they could not sort of thought it to expand in Cyprus. So that was.
Just if I may, I mean the story on the just something on Constantino, on what Constantino said. I mean the whole story with the increase of the interest rates. It started when it was just as soon as the crisis started in Greece. Bank of Piraeus, for example, was offering rates at 4.5. The local banks responded immediately. The cooperatives followed, and immediately, I mean, to just hold, they just fell into that vicious circle of increasing the deposit rates, going on the, also on the loan rates, and it stayed that high. But I wanted to ask a question, Constantino, because it's an issue which you mentioned, and it's what concerns also the credit rating agencies. It's at the current juncture. I mean, at some point we are today. What they seem to be more worried about is the exposure to the about of the Cypriot banks on their loan portfolio in Greece. How could the banks, for example, address that issue? This is the one thing. And the second thing, with regards to their capitalization needs they have vis-à-vis the EBA requirements, we see that, for example, Bank of Cyprus particularly has been a bit more proactive with the COCOS. Then also, Marfin, like if followed with the hybrid capital, how do you see them? How do you see that their efforts of drawing capital from the private sector ending? I mean, what is your personal assessment in that?
Maybe we should operate on the Chatham rules. on the first exposure to Greece, well, what? I think investors have a lot of questions about the health of the Greek loan portfolios of the banks. So the greater transparency you can provide, the better. You will have to provide that transparency anyway if you are going to attract a strategic investor. And we're talking now about those two big banks having valuations of 300 to 400 million at the same time when you need to attract 2 billion in capital. Any new investor is going to want control. To take control, they will want to see They want due diligence. They will want to see what the downside is in Greece. Not only the situation to stabilize, but also the downside. So, and related to that, and going to the EBA requirements, obviously Bank of Cyprus starts at a better position. As the Irish saying goes, I wouldn't start from here for Marfin. So that's where the role of the government and the central bank comes in, which is how can you ensure you get a strategic investor that can take care of these banks or at least help them recapitalize to maintain, but yet maintain the integrity of the Cyprus financial system.
What do you think it's been? The corporate governance issues, the fact that these banks, especially the Bank of Cyprus, has a lot of sort of family-owned...
Well, it goes back to this issue of transparency. I mean, we didn't discuss policy measures to deal with systemically important financial institutions. The typical policy measures being discussed at the international level have to do with additional loss absorbency, so higher capital ratios, better resolution tools, and the authorities are already taking steps to give themselves more tools to work the banks, so it's not just a binary option, nationalize or let them fail. And the issue of liquidity. Liquidity is thankfully, thanks to historical regulations, been there for a long time, is not such a big issue, at least for one of the two big banks. What is not given as much attention internationally, I think, and it should be definitely given much more, is governance. If you are talking about a systemically important bank, which becomes a public interest entity, you have to have much stricter governance rules. And those have to do with the composition of the board, the qualifications of board members, and the independence requirements. And there are issues there that have to be dealt with for both of those two banks.
Thank you very much.
Just to give you, picking up on the... question of transparency, it took me, I did an article on how much, this was back in April last year, how much are the banks exposed to Greece, and it took me several weeks to get the data together, and only because of one very friendly person in a bank that will remain nameless, literally said, look there, look at the slide number 12 on that bank's investor presentation, and you basically put it together siga-siga, as it were, but it took several weeks. And then when it was published in the Financial Mirror, one of the banks, which, of course, they advertised with the Financial Mirror, was absolutely furious with the Financial Mirror for daring to publish such a thing because it was, you know, exposing their weaknesses. And I think this is a tendency to try and brush the problems under the carpet rather than actually deal with them. But in terms of... There's two... You know, the risk, the sovereign debt exposure is smaller, but it might happen overnight. So a 50% haircut happens, you know, the same moment. The lending to Greece, I think they will be lucky to get 50% of that back. But you can write that off little by little every quarter. And I think that's practically just what they have to do. It's just write a bit more off every quarter and just, you know, hold on as long as possible. But yeah, how you actually persuade a strategic investor is another question.
I'm afraid.
Yeah, the program is such, in the case of the Greek banks, envisaged also, yes, but it envisaged an independent evaluation of the quality of the loan portfolios for the big banks in Greece done by BlackRock. That was only done for the Greek banks, not for the Greek operations or the Cypriot banks. The results from the BlackRock analysis could be useful as benchmarks for the kind of, for the quality of the loan portfolios, perhaps, of the Greek bank operations or the Cypriot banks.
So what was the indication about the percentage of loans that would be recovered?
It's not public information. It's now been discussed. It's been delivered to the Bank of Greece, and something will come out next month, I think, as part of a broader announcement of how they will go about recapitalizing the sector.
I think we have to bring it to a close, unfortunately, but there will be later on, I think, the opportunity to ask questions. So I would like to thank both of our presenters here.
Well, let me thank everybody for staying, for coming to this conference, and for staying until this for this panel. I'm very happy to be chairing this panel in particular. We've heard a lot about the financial sector, the fiscal situation, the view of the credit rating agencies. It's about time to shift to the real economy and see what is the real situation. I am a friend of the real analysis of the real economy. I don't hide this, and I'm very happy that we're talking about two sectors in particular, not the typical sectors you would be looking at in the real economy, not the manufacturing, perhaps construction, distribution, but two sectors that are very important for this Cyprus economy, the tourism sector, and of course the new developments with energy and wealth management as an implication to that. And we have two very distinguished experts who can talk about this issue. Our first speaker is Sofronis Kliridis. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Cyprus. He has studied in the US, has a PhD from Yale University, and has worked in different places in the US and Europe, and is currently a research affiliate at the Center for Economic Policy Research, and as I said, also teaches at the University of Cyprus. Our second speaker, Professor van der Ploeg, if my Dutch pronunciation is correct, is Professor of Economics, co-director of the Oxford Centre for the Analysis of Resource-Rich Economies at the University of Oxford. He has served, experience in many universities, but also has served in government, I think, in policy making, and he also has very, very extensive experience about policy making at the international level, and he's going to be talking exactly about resource-rich economies, the situation, with some reflections, I hope, for Cyprus. I'll ask the speakers to try to keep the presentations to 20 minutes, so that we have another 20 minutes for discussion at the end. On this note, I pass the floor to Professor Kliridis.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for organizing this and inviting me. Let me see if I can find my slides here. Okay. There you go. So I'm going to try and talk a little bit about the future of Cypriot tourism. By the way, the color of the slide does not really reflect my opinion on the future of the Cypriot tourism. And you're probably, this is a little bit of a distinction here between the past and the future. Kind of, I'm talking about the sector that sort of carried the Cyprus economy over the last 20 years, especially during the 80s and 90s. And Rick is going to talk about the future, which is probably a little more exciting, but tourism is still an important part of the Cypriot economy, so it's still worth talking about. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a historical background, talk about the contribution to the economy, try to talk a little bit about the reasons that caused the decline that the sector is in, has been in, and then have some thoughts about the challenges we currently face and prospects for the future. So this is, I'm just going to show you some numbers now from, most of these are going to be from 1976 to 2011. Some of the 2011 years figures are my own guesstimates, projections, so, but it should be about right. So this just, usually we measure the size of tourism by two or three metrics. One is the number of arrivals, okay, number of, it's body count, basically. So you can see that there was a huge increase in the number of tourism arrivals in the starting in the 70s, exploded in the 80s, continued to rise very, very fast in the 90s, reached a peak at about 2001, and then it declined, and so it's been basically hovering around 2.5 million arrivals or just below 2.5 million arrivals per year during the first decade of this century. You see there was a big decline in 2008 and 2009, actually, which was the year after the crisis started. And then you see the big upturn 2011, last year, which was a 10% increase. You will see that reflected in the revenues also. We basically have the Russians as US. I think actually Fiona presented some of these numbers in a different, slightly different way, but basically we have the Russians to thank for that upturn. Okay. So these are revenues. So let's see, the blue line is, no, what color is that? I'm not sure what color that is. It's orange on my screen, but it's not orange on the, it's kind of greenish on the board up there. So it's, that's current prices, and the blue one is constant prices. So this is revenues from tourism. Again, it's kind of pretty much the same picture. 2001 was the peak year, and then it went a bit downhill from there. It there was a bit of an upturn in the mid 2000, the mid of the zeros, 05, 06, and then again it turned south again over the last 3-4 years. Again, with the exception of last year, and again the last year we don't know if this was if this is a trend. Somebody mentioned, or it might have been due to the Arab Spring. We have to wait and see if that positive trend continues this year. I think that the signs are not that optimistic from what I hear from the reports that are coming in. So maybe it was a lot of it was due to the Arab Spring. This is an interesting number. So this is the revenue per arrival. So we just divide the revenues by the number of arrivals. So the blue line, I think I switched the colors, actually. So I think the blue line is current, and the green line is constant. It's actually quite striking. I was really surprised when I saw this. So as you can see, if you look at the nominal numbers, the blue line, it peaked in about 2001, and then started decreasing, or is pretty much flat since then. But in real terms, and real is not, it's not clear exactly how you deflate this, but roughly speaking, real revenue per arrival has been declining since the 80s, which is was a bit shocking, actually, when I saw this. Those are the broad patterns. So one other important thing is where are the tourists coming from. So these pie charts here show you where they're coming from. The big piece of the pie is the UK, of course. It was 56% in 2005. It's down to 43% in 2011. The blue part, which is the one that really grew big, is Russia. It was 5% in 2005. It grew to what is it? 14% of the pie in 2011. I mean, that's a pretty huge increase. And then the other countries are in Germany, Greece, Sweden. So, I mean, this sort of shows a dependence on British tourists, which was also mentioned earlier. You don't really, you know, tourism is a volatile sector to begin with, and it's even more volatile when you depend on one country. A downturn in the UK means downturn in Cypriot tourism, and really you can definitely see the difference. So the next thing I want to talk about a little bit is, so just look at the contribution to the Cyprus economy. So one common measure we look at is the revenue as percent of GDP. So you can see that from the late 80s to about 2000, it hovered around 20%, which is very large. Okay, and then it's declined to below 10% the last 2 or 3 years. So that's sort of one way of measuring the importance of the sector. Another way is to look at employment. So Fiona showed some figures which were a little different, but not too different. So maybe, I'm not sure if you... So this is the hotels and restaurant sector, which is... We don't really have any good figures actually on how many people are actually employed in the tourism services. So this is probably the closest you can get. It's the hotel and restaurant sector. Not every restaurant at least can be linked to foreign tourists, and there's also people who are not in this sector but are working in the tourism sector, for example, travel agents and so on. So these numbers are about 30,000 people, roughly speaking. So you can see it's pretty flat since 1995. It's about 32,000 people, roughly speaking. You can add probably, you know, maybe 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 more in related sectors like travel agents, tour guides, and so on. So it's about 10% of the workforce. So it's pretty significant. It's been going down a little bit. As you can see, it's now closer to 9. But what's more striking is this picture where... So these are actually the numbers. So it starts from 30,000 in 95, and it's up to about almost 35,000 in 2010. So that's the total. This is, again, in the hotels and restaurants sector. But the line at the bottom is the number of foreign workers in the hotel and restaurant sector, according to official statistics. Okay, and by 2009, basically half the workers in the sector were non-Cypriots. Okay, so this relates to a lot of the things we discussed earlier today about the labor market. It's basically a very competitive sector. You have to compete. It's probably the sector that has to compete most fiercely with internationally. Like, so I'm sure that all the British tourists can choose between Cyprus and many other places. Costs, you know, there's a big push to keep costs down, and one way of keeping costs down is to substitute the local workers with foreign workers who are cheaper. So another thing that we don't often talk about, we often talk about the benefits of tourism, you know, what it brings to the economy. There's also a lot of sort of hidden costs and sort of implicit subsidies that we don't even hear about. There's a misplaced emphasis on the size of the sector. You know, everybody was always talking about the number of arrivals and the revenues that we get. I mean, the revenues is good, but especially the focus on arrivals is a little bit misplaced, I think. There's not that much discussion of, what actually the costs of having a tourist sector of this size. Kind of like it reminds me of the talk about having a banking sector of that size, actually. What exactly is the value added of this? For example, there's a significant environmental cost that is not really taken into account in when we talk about, the benefits of the tourism sector in relation to resource use, things like basic stuff like water use, for example, or basic resources like space. So most of these are either grossly underpriced or not priced at all. So that's an implicit subsidy. Pollution is also another issue that having so many tourists, creates pollution. So all these things are costs that don't really go into this calculation we usually make about the benefits of tourism. There's also other things like the fact that we pay unemployment benefits to... we basically allow hotels to close down for half the year, and we pay unemployment benefits to their workers. So basically we're implicitly subsidizing the hotels. So those are things that, in real cost-benefit analysis, you would have to take into account, right? And we don't really. So to summarize the key observations from these sort of figures is that, so we had basically 25 years of rapid growth from the war onwards until about 2001. The sector has basically been in decline since 2001. From about 20% of GDP in revenues down to below 10%. The revenue per arrival, remember, it has been in decline since the mid-1980s. It just shows how competitive the sector is, basically, right? And total employment has been more or less steady, but half the employees in the sector are now non-Cypriot, okay, which is an important figure. And the other point is that you know, costs are not really fully accounted for. So one question is, should we really be worried about this? Okay, and I think we probably all agree that there was over-dependence on tourism. It's probably not healthy to have a sector as volatile as tourism, being dependent on a sector like that. So its relative decline was probably a natural thing. It was probably even a good thing, I would say, for the most part. It basically means that for part of this time that it was declining as a percent of GDP, it was actually growing at a pretty good pace. It was just that the rest of the economy was growing at a faster pace, right? Which can only be a good thing. So, you know, the rest of the economy was growing, the financial services were growing, tourism was growing at a slower pace, so it, relatively speaking, it declined, but it was still actually growing. So that's definitely not a bad thing. What looks a little more worrisome is the decrease in revenues per arrival. And this is basically a result of two factors. One is declining quality, which we'll talk about in a second, and the other one is increased competition. So if you, just looking at the numbers, basically, I'm sure most of you know the history, but there was a huge, the quality of the infrastructure has deteriorated basically over the years. There hasn't been enough investment, private or public, so the lack of competitiveness has led to creating jobs that are mostly unskilled or low-skilled that Cypriots don't want to do, and therefore the sector relies on importing foreign workers. Okay, there's over-dependence on one or two countries. It was the UK, now it's the UK and Russia. Actually, by the way, the Russians are preferable to, in some sense at least, to British tourists because they spend a lot more, apparently. They're the top spenders. If you look at the numbers of how much they spend, Russia's the number one. There's also the fact that you depend on only a few countries also means you depend on these giant tour operators which have a lot of market power, and they basically squeeze the hotels until they're dry. As the fact that we're ignoring the environmental impact is also a problem. And basically, we're kind of stuck in a sort of low value-added activity, which was probably good in the 1980s, but it's not really what Cyprus wants to be doing in the 21st century. So the problem with the quality is that, as you saw, there was huge investment in the sector in the 1980s. It sort of progressed. It started after the war. It started in Limassol, and then in the 80s, it moved to Yanapa and area, and then in the 90s, it was in Paphos. So there was a huge investment in that period. And this infrastructure is now dated, right? So hotels get old, they need renovation. At the same time, especially after 1990, new competitors came into the market. This is an international market, right? You have countries like Egypt, like Turkey, Croatia, Bulgaria. These countries came into the market with brand new facilities, very, very low wages. It's extremely difficult to compete in terms of price. Okay, the hotels are basically struggling to compete with in terms of price with these countries. Right? If you look at we've done actually at the university in collaboration with the Cyprus Tourism Organization, we've done a series of tourist satisfaction surveys. And then, basically, the tourists are overall pretty happy, but they complain about three, four things. Number one is always value for money. Okay. They always complain that Cyprus is too expensive relative to the quality of the tourist product it offers. The other things they complain is transport, or lack of it, or the quality of it, public and private. The state of the natural environment, which is code word for cleanliness, and the state of parks and nature generally. And the other one is the quality of the built environment, which is basically means things like sidewalks and places to walk and generally generally the quality of the built environment. Okay. Now, most of these are public policy issues, right? So you don't, if you look at those surveys, you don't really see that many complaints about the, sort of the quality of the hotels, for example. Tourists are pretty happy with the quality of the hotels overall. Most of the things they complain about is infrastructure, things like the roads and the sidewalks and no bicycle paths and things like that. And these are public policy issues, and these are public policy issues that affect not just the tourists, but also the locals. Right? I mean, these are the things that I complain about. Right? The fact that there's no public transport, the fact that there are no sidewalks, the fact that there are no parks, you know. And so that's kind of what's missing from the equation. So what is it we need to do? So basically, the first thing we need to do is take into account all when we design tourism policy for the sort of 21st century, we should really be thinking about all the costs and benefits associated with tourism. We should really be thinking about the environmental impact of tourism, and so shift the focus away from numbers of, you know, body counts and shift towards higher quality tourism. These would require designing some policies, some of which, you know, have been discussed in the past. And so let me take a minute to talk about this parenthesis I have there, which is, even though it's in smaller letters, it's actually very important. We heard earlier, like Moritz Kramer talked about the difficulty of the political institutions to respond to the crisis. And a big problem is that our political system has a hard time making difficult decisions, and an even harder time implementing difficult decisions. So a lot of the things that need to be done, everybody knows what they are. Like, I mean, all the stakeholders, well, with the exception of the implicit subsidies and that, you know, stakeholders don't really want to talk about, but everything else, you know, this the need to shift to quality, everybody knows that, everybody agrees. If you look at the strategic plan that it was commissioned by the CTO back in 2000, it has all the right things are in there. Okay, the marinas and the golf courses, all this stuff. We've been talking about this for the last 15 years at least. Finally, we're beginning to actually make a little step forward, and it took the crisis to actually get us to do this. Right. So the system is having a very hard time, you know, just making decisions and sort of moving forward. And the other issue is that there's substantial, if you really want to upgrade, you move on to the next quality level, you need substantial public investment to improve the things, the infrastructure that we talked about. And so this is not a very good time to be talking about the need for public investment, but that's what you need to do. And the private sector also needs to invest, but I think it would get the public sector to move in order to convince the private sector that, you know, it makes sense for me to invest. If I were to summarize my vision for the tourism sector of the future, I would see a smaller tourism sector aiming at a, you know, top end or, you know, a higher quality level, top end of the market, that would generate, you know, somewhere between 5% and 10% of GDP, with fewer people. Or at least maybe if it's the same, roughly the same number of people, but spread over the year, it's criminal to have the hotels closed for half the year. I mean, do you know what the weather is like in November or in March in Cyprus? It's, you know, 25 degrees. I mean, people should be dying to be there, and we close the hotels. It's insane. And then we give unemployment benefits to the workers. So we should expand the season. Fewer tourists because that's taking into account the environmental cost, but higher quality. Higher quality tourism also means higher, better quality jobs, like not just unskilled jobs, but jobs like, you know, you want chefs, you want to have higher quality, you have good chefs, you have guides, you have, you know, historians who work at museums. You create higher quality jobs also. We need to be less dependent on particular countries or one or two tour operators and be more environment friendly. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
serious issue to take up from the presentation, but let's move on to Vic's presentation, and then we can take questions from both of the topics.
That's what it is. Gentlemen, I think. Okay. Was it F10 or something? Okay. I've only been 3-4 times to Cyprus, so I don't know much about it. So, but I will try to say a few things about it by what we know about other economies who are getting a lot of gas. So in the literature is often called the resource curse. So the question you're also thinking about a traded sector like tourism, would it be hit very much after you find a lot of gas? So let's talk a bit about it. So there's this gas field appropriately called the Aphrodite gas field, isn't it? I mean, and it's south of Cyprus, and it's about estimates are always dodgy, yeah, because you know for sure there may be 5, but there may be 8, and there may be even more. So by the time you start drilling or by the time you start exploring, you may find more. It's offshore, which is good and it's bad. For many reasons. So there is a lot of complicated technology involved there. So you immediately think of a country like Norway, who's got a lot of experience on that. It's an area south of the concession has been given to Noble Energy. It's an area of about 100 square kilometers in the sea. It's not that far from that Israeli field. So it's not onshore, it's offshore, and I think that's actually good. Now then I thought, is it big or is it small? Well, it's of course very small compared with the two big players, Iran if you look at Iran or Qatar, they have 1,000 trillion cubic feet and 900 cubic feet. So they're colossal. But I thought, how does it compare with countries like the Netherlands or other European countries like the UK or even like Norway? Then of course Cyprus has a relatively small population. So if you just scale it up to the, you know, comparable size of population, then in actual fact, the gas reserves of the Netherlands are 40 trillion cubic feet. For the UK, there's only 9 trillion cubic feet left. And Norway still has a lot of it left. It's about 72. So if you scale it up, then compared with the Netherlands, it has 2.5 to 4 times as much gas reserves per inhabitant as the Netherlands. So I think that's big potatoes. You know, so, and compared with Norway, it's only about a half, say between 40 and 2/3, depending on how much you actually find. So, given that Norway is a gas-rich country, it's actually, you know, it's not enormous. It's not like Qatar or Iran, but it's potentially big, also in terms of public revenue. If you compare it with the UK, if you were to scale up to the population, you can't really do it. But still, I mean, it is actually much larger because the gas in the UK is mostly gone, and of course, the UK has got oil as well. So I would say that Cyprus doesn't have colossal reserves, but it has sizable reserves. It's enough to worry about, and particularly because it's a small economy, an island economy, which is not very well diversified anyway. I mean, it's you know, we just had one of the sectors, the tourist sector, which is a bit in decline. And we wonder what will happen to Cyprus once this happens. And also we want to ask ourselves the question, how should you manage these gas things? So I won't talk today, although it would take hours, about the contract theory we know on how to allocate the contracts. That's a separate thing. It's very complicated. And almost every country which does it wrong, undoubtedly Cyprus as well. But that's too specialized, so I won't talk about it. So what I will talk about is, type of questions is, is there more to this curse than Dutch disease in the declining traded sector? How about corruption, conflict, or rent-seeking? We had a lot of that in the Netherlands. We think Netherlands is a country which is not very corrupt. Well, it is, and it's what a lot of those gas-induced. So the big question is, how can you transform this gas into assets above the ground, which may be sovereign wealth, or it may be public infrastructure, what we were arguing for. And indeed, the question is, what should it be? I mean, like, if I'm in Ghana, which is very different from Cyprus. In Ghana, they have real capital scarcity. They don't have good access to the international capital market. So they're constrained. So there's a lot of public investment projects they can't do. So maybe for them it makes sense to use some of their windfall to actually use that for public investment. But you know, you look at Cyprus, it's basically quite well integrated into the world capital market. So really, I mean, think of Feltz and Oriaka. I mean, it's really the size of the windfall should have nothing to do with how much you invest doing public investment. These are kind of separate decisions. It's a kind of separation theorem. If you want to do public investment, that's fine. You can borrow for that on the international market, and if it gets a market return on it, and if it's socially and economically desirable, then you should do it anyway, independent of the gas windfall. That is a very important point, because in the Netherlands, a lot of the gas was used for a big public infrastructure fund. It's called a fund for economic strengthening the economic infrastructure. And it was great. You saw all these politicians and things like that, and they were building railroads from nowhere to nowhere, and roads from nowhere to nowhere. We had this huge freight railway from the port of Rotterdam going into the hinterland. Our hinterland was Germany, of course, and going all the way to Basel. And, of course, it was billions that were spent on it, mostly gas money. And, of course, no private, very important to have public-private partnerships if you spend money like that anyway. But it was all financed by the government, and now the thing is empty. Now the government is subsidizing the freight companies to do it. And we had very cheap transport. We had this thing called a river, and you had boats on it, and you go on there. They were doing it cheaper, and they're still doing it cheaper. So billions of money wasted, which would not have been wasted if there wasn't a gas. So the first lesson is a lesson you need to learn, that a lot of money is going to pour in, and you can just waste it away and throw it away on bad projects. And every politician with every constituency will find a worthy cause to spend it on. So there is, that's a big lesson. And it happens in the most civilized countries. So it's not just in corrupt African countries. It happens in countries like the Netherlands as well. So Norway, for example, what they did is they set up a completely independent fund. It's basically their old pension fund, and they dress it up. And in the old pension fund, the idea was it's called an intergenerations fund, and they put the money going into an intergenerations fund to basically smooth, because the windfall is going to be temporary, to basically be able to, and after the windfall is gone, the gas is finished, that you've got sufficient assets in it to live on the interest afterwards. Like, think of the permanent income hypothesis. And they made it completely independent. It was not a part of the Ministry of Finance. And most of the governments, the politicians fight about it. It's ethical investment, that it doesn't go into arms, that it's not environmentally unfriendly. And it's kind of a nice model which has been used in many, and I'm very much against that model in developing countries like Ghana or like in African countries, because they will have real capital scarcity. But say for Cyprus, it's not completely unreasonable to put it up there and to also make sure that it's independent a little bit away from the claws of the politicians. I'm saying this as an ex-politician myself. So give you some examples. Most of the examples we know, and I can give you a lot of econometric evidence, I'm not going to do it, it's been really, really bad. So you see, particularly in terms of growth performance, almost all the oil economies we can think of, although they may be richer, some may be less rich than others, but most of them are quite wealthy, they've often had negative growth rates. So Venezuela, Iran, Libya, Kuwait, Qatar, OPEC, for decades they've had negative growth rates, even though they had this huge windfall. So they were rich, but growth rate was declining. The Dutch economy didn't suffer from it. What we were doing is we were just dressing up the welfare state. In one point, Chris remembers that perhaps there were people like a third of the nation or something like that, a million of the labor force were ill. So you'd look at your colleague and say, hey, you're looking a bit peaky, you're looking a bit depressed. And you go home and say, well, fuck, he says I'm a bit depressed. And then he says, well, you are depressed. And he says, oh, well, I'm depressed, I might as well be ill. And then nobody checks anymore because the money is there. So the welfare state becomes completely ridiculous. So you'll worry about paying people half the year. There'll be more pressure and there'll be more political strength to actually allow that to happen. So it'll be more difficult to undo these ridiculous policies. So it's not just in terms of doing the wrong type of investment. So the type of investment people will typically go for. So rather than going for non-partisan investment, I think you should go to liquid, non-partisan sovereign wealth funds, perhaps. What you would typically find is that politicians will find partisan investments, and think, of course, which is appeals to that particular electorate, to that particular constituency. And this may not be the best investment from a growth-promoting point of view. Okay, there. So this is this negative correlation between growth rate and natural resource exports as a percentage of GDP. There's a Sachs-Warner study, and there are millions of studies after that. Most of them are pretty bad, because this is just a partial correlation. But there's been recently more work done for based on experimental work, natural field experiments and other stuff. It seems to suggest that there are some negative effects. There are positive effects. So Norway is an example. Botswana is an example, or the only example in Africa. Botswana is a diamond economy, owned by De Beers. Half of it is owned by De Beers from South Africa. And you compare that at the same time, we're about as poor as Nigeria 30, 40 years ago. Nigeria completely screwed up and been flat like that for many, many years. Now Botswana is about 10 times as rich in terms of GDP per capita as Nigeria. Some of these countries have transformed their oil wealth or their gas wealth into huge public infrastructure projects. So modernizing it. So you think of the United Arab Emirates. But others, so like Kazakhstan, partially by misguided advice by this guy called Richard Porter. Have you heard of him? I mean, completely ridiculous. So you should have all these special things, like we put a brain park here and we put lots of buildings there, and then we'll suddenly become the brain parks of the world. So they've got all these beautiful, shiny buildings in Kazakhstan. I was there only a few months ago. And what are they being used for now? What is Kazakhstan known for? Kazakhstan is Cyprus for grapes and olives, for apples. It's the apple state of the world. So now these big, shiny buildings are now apple storehouses. It's ridiculous. So as an example of how things can go wrong, the best example was, Norway today, but now the States. If you go back to the old economic history books by Habakkuk or Paul David and Gavin Wright and others, then you find that in the States much of the growth in the mid-19th to mid-20th century was resource-driven, and it was really because the government claimed no ultimate title to mineral rights. Not sure whether we can learn much from that for Cyprus. So, but typically, there's a whole lot of bad things associated with it. Most of these stuff underlying deep studies. I just did a big study, more academic, econometric work, that you showed that if you get a boom in FDI, this is a big. It's coming out of the Review of Economic Statistics, and you get a huge negative effect of non-resource FDI. So it's empirically a large thing. So it's maybe because the whole country or the whole island gets geared up towards the gas, and it attracts all the capital, attracts all the clever people, it attracts all the talent, it attracts all the political attention. And then as a result, and maybe the other FDI that should be going to growth-promoting sectors, the ones you've been arguing for, to diversify, that'll be lost out a lot. So this may be actually one of the most worst forms of curses there are. So there you go. To do some of that stuff. So how does it work? I'll give you some explanations. So some of you will know this, others not, and if you know it, then it's nice to hear something you know. So the normal story is, so how does Dutch disease work? Yeah. So you will become all very rich. Yeah. So you get gas. And maybe some one way or another it will come to you. If it doesn't come to you in the future, it will come to you now via some Ricardian argument. But maybe it even comes to you because you get citizen dividends, like in Alberta. But anyway, because a huge extra demand, either by the public sector or the private sector, for products. Now, some sectors can't do it because they're non-traded sectors. So think of construction, think of barbers, think of hotel sectors. So the construction sector, prices really go up. So you see wages going up, prices going up. And that means that the only way it can happen is that for the traded sectors to decline. So because there you can always import products from the world market. So what you will see is that there's going to be shifting of factors of production, capital and labor, from these traded sectors to these non-traded sectors. And the point is, it relates a bit to your point, that where the real growth is coming from is typically are these traded sectors, industrial sectors and other sectors, but also financial services sectors. These are typically traded nowadays. And tourism is, of course, par excellence a traded sector. So then you will find that you get an appreciation of the real exchange rate. I say, we're in the euro, we've got one currency. Yes, it's true, but it's the real exchange rate that matters. So what you will see is that these non-traded sectors, they will expand, often they're government sector, they're often heavily subsidized at the expense of traded sector. And it may be very bad for growth. That's typically what will happen, because most of the learning by doing arguments, most of the growth elements happens in these traded sectors, and if they don't decline, that's the experience we have in many other countries. That's bad for the country. So that's the main reason for this gas curse. There is a detailed argument, which I will leave for those of you who want to do that. For a small country, for a small island, there may be a thing which goes against it, that if lots of factors of production are drawn into the gas sectors, which may be true for a small island, then and if the trading sector is capital intensive, then the gas boom could actually introduce pro-industrialization. Looking at some of the back-on-the-envelope calculations for Cyprus, I don't think this effect is that large. The main problem you're going to have, particularly for a Minister of Finance, that you're going to have a big chunk of your government revenue which is going to be really volatile. Because if the oil price or the gas price can go up from $30 a barrel to $50 or $100 or $150 a barrel, it goes up and down like a yo-yo. So you need a fund. Your sovereign wealth fund is not just to spread your oil wealth or your gas wealth across generations, that you don't eat it all now but leave some for future generations. That's a kind of an intergenerational motive for having a sovereign wealth fund. But there is also a liquidity fund or a stabilization motive for having it. So the way to do it then is, for example, which would be called precautionary saving, which you can then try to argue. That's the second reason. And the third reason for it, if you could spend it, often the capacity is not there to do it. There's a parking fund motive for having a wealth fund. If there's no way of spending the money fruitfully because you're not ready yet up to full capacity. So I will drop a lot of stuff here to show that if you look at the resource curse, most of the effects, what we can show is that the resource curse, the bad effects of resources on growth, are mainly operating via the increased volatility. And it's the increased macroeconomic volatility which destroys growth prospects. That's actually much more important than the deterministic story. I'm going to say a few sentences about policies. So see, I'm going quickly through it, you see. I will say something about volatility in 2 minutes, I'll be finished. Don't worry. So volatility is going to be a big issue. Because, of course, when the price is high of your gas or oil, then everybody will want to spend it. Or maybe even borrow on the base of that. There's a lot of excessive borrowing that's been going on. And then when the prices go down, you're stuck. You're really screwed. So you want to avoid it. Now, some people, do you remember the big guy? Not the Greek Minister of Finance, the Mexican one. Exactly. The good guy, if you were a Chicago guy, he's a good guy. But he would have been a good manager of the IMF, I think. He would have been a good boss of the fund. So he's a bit of a gambler. But he's one of the few countries, although apart from Mexico, Ecuador, Colombia, some of these other countries, people have tried it a little bit, is to hedge. You could argue, maybe for a country like Cyprus, you could hedge a little bit. But of course, there are problems with market power, there are problems with the market impact of hedging. But what he basically did, he put in about a billion, he put a floor into the Mexican hedge level at about 70. Then the oil prices really went down. And then the orangey bit of the region is the amount of money he pocketed. So he made a couple of billion money on it. Of course, people loved him for it. But still, if you ask most developing countries, if you would spend a billion up front, kind of as an insurance via some hedge or some other, there are all kinds of options you can use to do it. You wouldn't use one of these options. Perhaps you would use more options which are cheaper than those. There are other options you can use. But then, is that an option for Cyprus? I don't know. Some people should look into it, because it's one way of kind of getting stability in your government finances. The other way is via the fund I talked about.
What happens if the price goes the other way?
If the other way, you're screwed. So what typically people have to make it cheaper, they have So what some countries have done, so it's for people who are interested, there are some IMF reports on it, is to have a cap on top and a cap below. But then the danger of that is that if the prices really go up, you're not benefiting from it, and that's political suicide as well. So my take on this is that it's a very risk. If I were a politician, I wouldn't do it. Because if it goes well, I won't get the gains from it, and if it goes well, I'm definitely dead. So I would argue for a proper fund with a proper buffer. What else would I do, and this is my last sentences, is this stabilization fund I talked about. And another one is to deal with residual volatility. That's the normal one you want to do. You want to have a flexible economy for labor markets, capital markets. You want to avoid commitments which are hard to reverse. You want to diversify. All of these things give you some kind of ways of coping with residual volatility which you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So I'll stick to this. So I think it's a big challenge for Cyprus. It's also a big opportunity, but there are many ways of messing it up.
Many interesting points pick up to the discussion. I reserve my life for later on, perhaps, and open it up for questions from the
Thanks very much to both. I'm going to ask Sophronis a question about tourism. Do you distinguish when you're looking at tourism, you point to the importance of UK tourism, how much of this is made up of family members, second generation? Because that seems to me to say something about trends in it and stability of it. And it seems to me that UK tourism might be very different from Russian tourism, which we sort of certainly expect to be very volatile. But UK tourism made up of family members going back seems to be a very different way of looking at things. Can you comment on that?
That's right. That's a big concern, actually. If you talk to the CTO or the hoteliers, they will tell you that this is a terrible thing that's happening. All the British people retiring and having homes in Cyprus and then either inviting all their friends over and so they get to stay at their home instead of staying at hotels. Or even there's a little market of, which is kind of an informal market of actually renting them out. So that's definitely a big concern. I don't know if I haven't seen actual numbers of how big this issue is, but it's definitely something that people are very aware of and very concerned about.
I would say that if they spend more time in Cyprus, then they spend more as well. So, you know, they don't seem to kind of not spend. You know, so they are affluent and they tend to kind of buy nice things, you know, go to nice restaurants. So they do spend. The multiplier effect is still there.
Yeah, I don't know if you would call that. It's a different kind of tourism, like you said. So I'm not sure if it's something that's above and beyond your normal tourism or if it's replacing it. So that's a big question. I don't know what the answer is to that.
Sounds more like remittances than tourism.
Yeah.
Question by Chris.
Well, this question is addressed to Rika. That despite the kind of confusing way that you presented your slides, I think they were actually very good. You made some very good points. But the way I see it, there are two big risks from this. One is the appreciation of the real exchange rate, and the other is volatility in prices. Now, in a country that is in the Eurozone, like Cyprus, that has no influence on the euro at all, then the appreciation of the real exchange rate can only come from wage rises that you get because of oil. And the volatility, of course, you get if you rely on current oil revenues to finance. Right? And both of those can be avoided if you have a sovereign fund, which is outside the influence of the government. So it seems to me that there's a very simple way of avoiding both the problems that you mentioned connected with the curse. Set up a sovereign fund and don't allow the government to touch that fund, except through some rule that is set up by Parliament, and the President cannot overrule it. Now, now you mentioned, like many other people mentioned, that the best kind of fund you could have is the Norway one. In fact, I talked to Norwegians involved with the fund. It will not work in Cyprus. It will be a complete disaster. The Norway fund is independent of the government, but it's controlled by the central bank, and it's obliged to give money to the government if the government requests money from the fund. So the only reason that the fund works is that the government is responsible. It doesn't draw down money from there to pay the civil servants higher wages and higher pensions. And in fact, in Norway, ever since the fund was set up, the government has never asked the central bank to give it money from the fund to finance a budget deficit. And that's why the fund is now worth about €1 million per citizen of Norway. Well, you may not be very familiar with Cyprus, can you imagine the Cyprus government knowing that it has a fund which is worth €1 million for each citizen and then never asking the bank to give it money? It will be asking it all the time. It will say, you know, exceptional circumstances. We're running out of money to pay pensions from age 55.
Does this work?
Yeah.
Okay, so the main point. Yes, you're right. I think a sovereign wealth fund would be the best for Cyprus for many reasons. And also a fiscal policy which kind of is also smooth because of that reason. Because if you had a spend-all policy where you would just, during a windfall, you would spend very much and then it would go down, you would have a very volatile real exchange rate, not from day to day, from month to month, but from over a 5 or 10 year chunk period. And by having a sovereign wealth fund and having this permanent income hypothesis or whatever you want to call it, you smoothed it out, and that's good. Now, coming to the Norway thing, there are, of course, many different ways of running a sovereign wealth fund. So I have a paper on Norway where it's actually extremely critical of Norway. Their policy is really a bird-in-hand rule. It's not really a smoothing rule. So they have a rule where they put all the money into the fund, and they only take out 4% per year. Yeah, and then they have a discretionary amount they can take out, which does vary a little bit from year to year. But basically, because of that, see, the problem for Norway is that they've got a declining oil windfall. It's running out by 2040, and from now onwards, they've got a rising pension bill, and that's really, really just when oil is running out, it's really going up. And the present value of that pension bill is much more than the present value of their oil fund. So they're actually not saving enough. So we could argue about that. But anyway, the point is that you should therefore not only look at oil, but you should also look at other future commitments of any country, which may be true for Cyprus as well. And I think the design of any sovereign wealth fund should be specific to a particular country. What is not specific to a particular country is that you should have a change to the constitution or some laws which basically make sure that it's independent, that the rules are completely transparent up front, and that everything gets published. Very few, even the Netherlands, it's very difficult to actually have a transparent knowledge of what happens to the gas, how much is pumped up, or how much it's sold, and where it's, and how it's spent on. All the pressure will be from the Ministry of Finance to hide it. So you need a law, you need a constitutional change which actually puts this transparency up front. So we've been involved with the revenue charter, with for example, changing the constitution of some countries to do exactly that. Of course, in some African countries, you can change the constitution and they'll still do whatever they want to do. But you would hope that in a country like Cyprus, it might be of some help. But that's extremely important. So for the rest, I agree with what you said.
We're a bit close to time. With time, so I'll take a couple of questions.
Good practices, bad practices on the implications of it for the pricing of the resource domestically.
Well, before you answer that, let me take another couple of questions.
Thank you. I mean, it's two points. The one is the role of fiscal policy in this context of the revenue resources. What is your view? Because there is so much in academia talking about the importance of containing the fiscal spending and sterilizing the proportion of these revenue windfalls on the one hand, and then coming a bit on the Norway example. The Norway example allows only to use the net present value of the estimated long-term return of this fund, which is 4%. That's the point. And at the same time, that's why they have around 50% of gross government debt. If there is legislation which controls this part, it's not a way to address the issue or that Professor Pissarides raised. I mean,
okay, if you can answer this very quickly.
I can do very quickly.
The technical details.
So I'll talk to you about it over a cup of tea. But your point is very important, because what will happen is, and of course, why should it be priced differently at home than abroad? Why should it be priced? Whereas most countries will get oil or gas. They have huge fuel subsidies, not only for the, I think Iran has actually reversed it, but if you think of Nigeria, you've read what's going on there, it's almost protests. Because they have these huge fuel subsidies, they try to take them away, and the country goes in protest. In other countries, you have fuel subsidies which are implicit. Like Holland is world famous for its horticulture and its tomatoes, which are shit, and for its hashis and whatever. But all of that is done on greenhouse gas, which is heavily subsidized. It's priced below the world market price. It's much better if it's done in Morocco rather than or in Cyprus. So there's a lot of hidden subsidies, basically, which amount to pricing below the world price for gas. I think that should, at all cases, should be avoided. And if you can put it in a law or in a constitutional thing, something like that, something about that as well, it would be very good.
Another round of questions. There's a question.
Robert McDonald from the EIU. Is the Nobel find proven or probable?
There is an amount of 3.7, I believe, but there are others in the room which will know better, which is proven. And then the others is probable. And then you can have much better, yeah.
We've seen Nobel at the end of January. The figures that they presented are credible, but they need to do some more drilling.
Okay.
And the minister.
Your permission, just for the to deal with this, but because I think there's also a question about the figures themselves.
Yeah, of course.
It's an estimated resource base of 5 to 8 TCF,
yeah,
with a mean of 7, because of probability.
That's the one I know of, yeah.
And as Theo has said, and Theo is a member of the team of experts who is advising the government on the next steps.
Seven of me.
The tests have been done of the actual samples of the gas have been taken and analyzed, and it seems that
we've passed our allocated time, and I'm conscious people may be also interested in the closing round table. So we'll stop here. Let me thank the speakers for a very good. Take a breath and continue with the next one.
Welcome to the final session. This is a roundtable where the objective is that each one of us here will have 5 minutes of glory where they'll say what they learned during the day, and then we'll open it up to discussions because it's very pleasing to see how many people have questions and, in fact, very good questions and discussions. And I'm going to go through the list in a kind of zigzag way. I'm going to start with the minister, then followed by Robert MacDonald, who has spoken before, and then Ellie here, then Kate, and last and definitely least, myself. So we'll start with Praxula, and if you could give it 5 minutes.
Okay, I don't know if it's productive to give a summary of what I said in the morning.
No, just tell us what you learned during the day, other than how delicious LSE food is.
Yes, I think the main benefit to the minister during the day is getting a feedback on how other experts view the Cyprus economy, its strengths and weaknesses. Of course, I sense that there was a bias on weaknesses. Somehow we need to enlighten better on the strengths that are there, and they are the ones which have helped the economy essentially weather the crisis, because I have to remind, let's say, all experts that despite the crisis, the fiscal debt is still, even after it has risen below 70% of GDP, which this shows sustainability. The fiscal deficit, though it had risen to 6% of GDP last year, it is targeted to remain below 3% this year, and already, even S&P's granted that austere measures have been introduced so that this target will be attained, as the Parliament has also approved the suggested measures by the government. So there's no question that these targets of fiscal discipline will be attained. The issue, as I had also indicated, is how to encourage and instigate growth again, which growth is
what will give long-term sustainability and also contribute to the reduction of unemployment. And Cyprus was never used to high unemployment, at least not the last time we had high unemployment was after the invasion of 74, when we had lost 40% of the production capacity. I do need to emphasize that I expect that the exposure of our banking system to Greek debt, though proportionally higher than in other EU countries, is manageable, and I do need to emphasize that not all the banking system has been exposed to Greek debt, and that has to be noted. So I do not expect that these two banks will need state help or fail. And anyway, the banking system in its entirety will weather the crisis. The difficulty, as I had indicated, is that because of a narrow liquidity, there is not sufficient liquidity now to finance domestic economic activity, which has started to pick up in response to gradually recovering demand. So we need to attract capital into the country, either by concentrating on those types of exports of goods and services that can bring more money to the country, starting with the services sectors, or capitalizing on the interest of foreign direct investors, which now manifests itself primarily as a result of the prospects that arise in the energy sector. And I do need to emphasize that there are short-term benefits that have also started to manifest themselves because of energy, in the sense of foreign direct investors starting to preparing to position themselves in the economy at the beginning of this new era. There are also structural changes and policy decisions that the government has taken to encourage several development projects in the country, whether these will be done by the government or by the private sector. I mentioned golf courses, oil terminals, incentives to new, to airlines to introduce new routes for tourists to Cyprus. And I indicated that perhaps these specific measures, which may seem trivial to a large country, in Cyprus, because we are speaking about small size, small specific measures can make a difference. So I have invited, let's say, the representative of the credit rating agency here, that perhaps more detail could be given to specific measures that the government is proposing, which, if attention was given to these measures that have already been taken, the outlook in the rating of credit rating institutions should have been positive. I am a bit critical about how the exposure of the domestic banking sector to Greek debt could have been prevented. But of course, this is not the time to go into that. I would agree that the banking sector is, of course, very large in relation to our GDP, and perhaps this questions the wisdom of previous policy making to allow the economy to depend on one sector. And as I had said previously, we are critical of over-dependence on tourism, and then instead of diversifying, we became over-dependent on the financial sector. So this should be a lesson, so that we should never become over-dependent on one or two sectors. Diversification is the way ahead, and even if we manage, and this is what it appears that it will be done, that energy will give this great boost to economic activity and employment in the future, we should never lose sight of competitive advantage in other sectors, tourism, other services. I had indicated private medical care, tertiary education, the professions, the engineers, the architects. So never lose sight of competitive advantage in other sectors so that we can have diversification and hence sustainability. Thank you.
Excellent. Exactly on time. Thank you very much. That's Robert.
Since we've just dealt with gas, I'd like to start with gas, the particular, and then move to a couple of general comments. My concern with the gas issue is that my question asked whether the reserves that had been discovered were proven or probable, and you weren't able to give me an answer to this. It's a very small reserve. From what I've read, it's good enough for 200 years of Cyprus's needs, but something like 5 months of European Union needs. So what are you going to do for the offtake? Are you going to pipeline this gas, and where? Are you going to put LNG facilities, and where? What is the expense of an LNG facility? What's it going to do to your tourist industry to have an LNG facility? It's a seismic area. Are you going to have the problems that they had in Greece with Revithoussa, building an LNG facility with seismic problems? Where is it going to go as LNG? The Qataris were looking at Astahos and building an LNG reception facility at Astahos, and for some reason they've pulled out of it. It seems to me that the only way that you're going to be able to use this gas outside Cyprus is to some way aggregate it with other gas from Israel, Egypt, use Book of Lebanon, possibly. But are the Qataris, if they are going to be the investors in the LNG reception facilities, going to be prepared to take Israeli gas together with Cypriot gas? There are a huge number of questions that have not been addressed here. And the obvious thing to do is to use it domestically and pipeline it directly to Turkey. But that's another issue that hasn't been raised and addressed. And that takes me to, I'll come back to that issue. I thought it was particularly interesting listening to what Bernard Casey had to say about the demographic issues. Reminded me of a number of things that we've seen in Greece. He's talking about the pension system absorbing 15% of GDP by 2060. They were talking about it absorbing 25% of Greek GDP by 2050, but they're now insisting that it be reduced to no more than 2.5% of GDP by 2050. 15% of GDP by 2060 is going to be a huge amount, particularly if, as you say, there's a 1.5-to-1 dependency ratio. You're facing a major, major crisis in terms of demography and pensions and looking after the elderly two, three decades down the road. And the other point that rather caught my eye was Mr. Christofidis' remarks about the minimum wage and what's happening with productivity versus wages. Minimum wage at 909 euros. The Greeks would love that. They're on 751, and last night we're told they'd have to take it down to 600 euros a month. 909 is quite high, particularly when in 2009, as he pointed out, you had 4% wage increases and 1% increase in productivity, and in 2010, 2.4% increase in wages, and I think he said 1.6% increase in productivity. So there's a disparity in wages and productivity there that is also going to have to be addressed. This raises everybody has spoken of the need for growth. This raises the question of the elephant in the room, which nobody's addressed, and I've asked permission if I can raise this. I think the one way you are going to get growth in Cyprus is through a settlement, and through a settlement that provides for development of the north, which will drive the growth. And you have all your best tourist facilities in the north, a very modest product in the south. You're talking about oil storage terminals, white and black, gas facilities perhaps in the south. Perhaps the best way to get long-term growth is to press ahead with a settlement at almost any cost, because over time, once you have a settlement, it will resolve itself. If you are allowed to buy back properties in the north over time, Greeks will buy back the north, the same way Greece bought Macedonia after all the rigors and the problems that were associated with the Macedonian question, I'm sorry, the Phirom question in Greece. So I think that there has to be a great deal of attention paid to the notion of a settlement as part of long-term growth, and the possibility of gas coming ashore may be the thing that drives that. Maybe your gas coming ashore can be used within the community, but pipelined to Turkey, and you can find some way of a quid pro quo with the Turks to balance a political settlement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, King.
Is it on? Wow, I don't know what I would say after that. First of all, I'm not going to be as technical and throw out statistics and percentages. I mean, from my perspective, I think that, as you all know, I'm based in the UK. I think it's a fascinating day to listen to so many different views and sometimes conflicting views. And so it was kind of an interesting day. I think that, as I mentioned earlier in one of my statements before, in my view, Cyprus has always ended up historically in ending up in a situation that global events conspired against Cyprus, and that's where we are in many facets in our political history. In my view, as was mentioned earlier by the minister, the banking and the financial crisis has been one example of mismanagement, and hopefully in the next few weeks or few months we will avoid the total crisis. And in my view, again, I hope that the opportunity with gas, I don't know, you seem to discount it totally. I wasn't aware of all these facts you said. I thought it was a big find. But if, as you say, it's totally small, then all this hoo-ha about it would be saving Cyprus and it would take us out of the calamity and economic disaster may has to be rethinked. I don't know. I mean,
Well, the appraisal wells will tell us. It's a big block. There are 12 more blocks up for development. Yeah. Maybe it will turn out to be a big find, but as it stands, it's a very, very modest find.
I do agree with you that regional cooperation it must happen. And, of course, the Cyprus problem being sorted out would be a huge impetus for that. But I will also say that we have to remember that we have a lot of positives in Cyprus. You know, the fact that we have a fantastic, educated supply of human capital. We have the strategic positioning of Cyprus and the ability to turn this around, and therefore we can get better by diversifying and focusing and making some changes that could attract more foreign nationals into Cyprus.
Thank you.
Well, the one thing that I have heard many times today is that Cyprus is becoming less competitive. And this is the one thing we have to really concentrate and improve. We've heard that with regard to tourism. We've heard it with regard to the banking sector. We've heard it from our labor market. The business sector is becoming uncompetitive, and we are losing to other markets. So the one thing we really have to make sure is that we provide enough flexibility in the labor market, for example, so that we improve our competitiveness. And this is really one of the key things. And the second point I want to bring out is with regard, coming back to the banking sector, which we talked extensively during the session, that I believe that the Central Bank of Cyprus has to show that it can handle concentrated systemic risk. I don't think it's enough to tell the banks recapitalize. It has to show to the world and to the financial community that it can really improve on the prudential regulations and of the banks, and that it can handle that. And also the last point that Konstantinos pointed out, and I agree absolutely, the central bank has to look in the medium term how to really restructure or help the banking sector, financial sector change so that it cannot run into the same problems again as we have done up to now. Okay, that's all.
Thank you. Then I'll summarize some of the points that I picked up. In fact, I've just focused on three points. I thought actually the discussion was very illuminating. I learned many, many things about Cyprus. It's been very high standard. But I'll pick up three things that haven't been mentioned very much before. Well, the first thing that struck me is something that Louis Christofidis said this morning, and I'm a bit surprised that it hasn't been picked up, because he started his talk by saying one of the advantages of the Cyprus labor market is that it has good industrial relations, but then spent the remaining 20 minutes of his talk telling us how bad the outcomes are in the labor market, which are all due to industrial relations. You know, for example, wage rises that are not matched by productivity, cost of living and allowances, and so on and so forth. And then, then of course, when we talked about pensions with Bernard Casey, again, we saw how bad the pension situation was in the public sector, and it was always the emphasis of public sector doing it, which is also due to union negotiations with the government. And of course, when Lewis was talking about wage rises, about productivity, I'm sure that was driven by the public sector, because in the private sector, they would have bankrupted the company. So it seems to me that a serious problem with the Cyprus labor market are the unions, and especially in the public sector, and I didn't hear any comment about that. It's something that I picked up from this morning's discussion. I'm not anti-union, as you know. I support union parties. Always voted for them, but this is what I learned this morning. Well, I also vote for non union parties, but I'm a floating voter, unlike most Cypriots. the second point that I learned, and I'm a little bit surprised and shocked, is that tourism is not such an important sector of the economy as we always thought. I thought it was the only export sector of Cyprus, but in fact, it's not even the most important. That it's declining. I mean, that it was declining, I've already noticed myself by looking around in the summer. It seems to me to be there also that also emphasis was completely misplaced. I mean, like even Sophronis mentioned in his excellent presentation, mentioned that, and someone else before then mentioned that there are golf courses being done in marinas. But that's not the infrastructure that Cyprus tourism needs. The infrastructure that Cyprus tourism needs is pavements where people can walk, it's clean beaches, it's roads that are clean, it's parks that you can go and sit on the bench. Like pavements in Cyprus, even where they exist, they become linear parking lots. I mean, no self-respecting Cypriot will park his car on the road if there is a pavement nearby. I was so shocked that in probably the best beach of Cyprus, which is in Makronissos, that the local authorities, rather enlightening there, and they put very thick iron bars separating the road from the pavements, and they drew lines on the road to make people park, and yet they went and removed those iron things with bulldozers, I expect, so that they could drive their 4x4s right on the pavement and push it against the wall of the nearby hotel. And if you ask why, well, because there were some of those linear cypress trees, what they call here the Italian cypress, in case it shades them. But even if it shades you, it will just be a straight line of shade going across your car. You know, this. It's crazy. I think it's deep in the mind of the Cypriot. So one way of and then tourists complain that there are no walks in Cyprus to take and transport is bad. Well, of course they will complain, because they haven't learned how to climb over 4x4s when they're walking from their hotel to the beach. And finally, oil and gas. Well, it's mentioned a few times. Actually, one thing I did learn from Rick's excellent presentation was that it's going to be a lot tougher setting up the fund to avoid the curse of resources than I thought before, because whichever way you look at it, even if we ignore all the problems that Robert was mentioning, there are still the financial problems of exactly how you set it up, and I don't think we've come to an agreement. That I studied the Norwegian fund very carefully, and I've come to the conclusion that it wouldn't be suitable for Cyprus for the reasons I mentioned. It needs much more political maturity than we have in Cyprus for that, with some notable exceptions, of course. But I don't think we'll work in the long run, so I leave that as an issue for the future. Now, this was the time that we were going to take questions, but our minister and guest of honor would like to do a rejoinder to some of the remarks that were being said in 2 minutes, and then we'll have
just to clarify a few facts, because I mean, some very good points were raised by Mr. McDonald. With reference to the size of the find, of the discovery, yes, it's just 5 to 8 TCF, but this is one of the sites. Because today energy was not the main issue, I didn't elaborate on that. We are just going out with a second round of licensing for 12 other sites in the exclusive economic zone of Cyprus, and seismic studies are indicating existence of reserves in almost all of these sites, in the same way that they were indicating the existence of reserves in Site 12, and seismic studies were proven right. So it's not that we are building the whole future on the findings of one site. It's times 13. Just because these are the facts, it's just because we didn't speak about energy today, so I didn't elaborate on that. So whatever plans will be made will have to refer to findings, probable for the rest, but seismic studies indicate that, of 13 times, let's say, on average, what has been discovered in Site 12. So it's in that sense, it's more long-term, but it's not small. And I wouldn't agree more with you that growth could indeed come from settlement. And the three ladies, myself, Fiona Mullen, and Osolemo Gyus, did studies on the economic benefits of a solution. But of course, it takes more than one just to tango to have a party. And as I had indicated in the morning, it is certainly to the best interest of the Eastern Mediterranean area if we find a way to resolve the problems of the past so that we can capitalize on the opportunities of the future. Because it's only through peaceful cooperation that we could move ahead. That's why we are actively searching for a solution of the Cyprus problem on the basis of the agreed United Nations framework, so that the country could reunify, we can all partake in whatever is coming, and so that relations with between the whole of Cyprus and Turkey normalize, so that we can become partners in peace in the future and cooperate even in the sector of energy. But in order to achieve that, we need many people to agree to participate in the party which we want to organize. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, we can take questions now. Yeah, this one. Luis. Wait a minute.
Just a comment on the apparent paradox that you mentioned. I think what I meant to say, and I thought what I said was that the legal framework is quite constructive. There is dialogue. The unemployment insurance system is reasonable. The welfare system is reasonable. At least I haven't seen studies that point out to anything different. Hiring, firing costs are pretty low. So there aren't the endemic problems that you have in some countries that cause people to have commissions and require very painful reforms of that type. Now, having said that, the other issues that I raised, I do believe, are problems that we need to look at.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like a reasonable framework with the wrong outcomes.
Well, don't forget that we've had a long period of growth where things were not pressed to their limit, and now they are.
Okay. Any? Yeah.
I want to underline Chris Pissarides' point about the pavements. I remember once upon a time taking a walk from the Ministry of Finance to Ledra Street one evening, and everybody looked at the pair of us as we were doing this as though we were completely mad. And indeed, given the state of the pavements, we were. But to come back to also the point about good industrial relations and bad outcomes, or possibly good politics, supposedly, and bad outcomes. One reads very often in European Commission reports that Cyprus gets praised for something called social partnership, and that always comes up, and that's a box which is ticked and which is seen as something positive. But if one looks at issues of industrial relations, and I think Louise is a bit too positive about this. One of the reasons why the labour market works is because, in a sense, people are undermining it, hence these references to foreign workers, hence the discussion of the tourism sector in particular. And one of the areas where it is not working, and I don't apologise for coming back to this, is this question of pension ages. People are refusing, and this is the thing which has struck me all the time that I have been working there, is that every time you put the pension age onto the agenda, it is wiped off time after time after time. People refuse to. And I want to know what people have been doing with the extra years of life expectancy at 65, which they've had since statistics go back, which I showed, and what they are going to do with the extra 5 years, which is projected for them over the coming 50 years. What are they going to do with that? Do they expect to use all of this in leisure? And why can one not talk about that subject? Thank you.
Mine follows on, really. I thought Kate gave a very good summary of some of the lessons from the discussions that we've had today about the need for greater competitiveness in a number of different sectors. And what struck me was, I think I would like to know a little bit more as to the extent to which public opinion is lagging behind that kind of agenda. The automatic wage indexation system is simply suspended for 2 years. It seems that we could well be in a situation where we have an agenda which is being fostered from outside, pushed from outside, but a huge time lag in terms of public opinion being able to sustain the kind of competitiveness which is allegedly necessary.
Okay, I would say that public opinion identifies itself with the existence of cost of living adjustments. I mean, it's part of life, and that's why it has helped towards the maintenance of good relations between the partners, employers, unions and the government. Okay, to the extent that we have, unprecedented changes in the environment, we have the developments that we have, but even during today's discussion, I don't think anybody has been convinced that the cost of living allowance was the cause of problems in Cyprus. Yes, it reduces flexibility in responding, but even with the abolition of cost of living allowance as a way of moving forward, would that solve all the problems of Cyprus? Is that the problem of competitiveness which Cyprus faces? Yes, we may be expensive, more expensive in some areas. I think Cyprus should concentrate more on quality and standards. It's not a market or destination that should be targeting to compete on the basis of cost. That would never be achieved. As a strategy and as a policymaker, I would advise, and this is the general view, that we should try and compete on the basis of quality. However much we reduce costs, we will never be able to compete in terms of cost levels with some other of the neighboring countries. So the trick is to become competitive in terms of the quality of the services being offered and of how professional we are, and I agree that we need to become more professional in some areas. Abandoning a cost of living, okay, will bring some short-term benefits in that for 1 or 2 years there will be reduction in real wages, but that will not do the trick. We need emphasis on quality, which is the real competitive advantage in an economy where its main strength is human capital. Human capital that relates to university graduates. We lack some specific skills, and again, we need to place emphasis on acquiring labor with such type of skills that currently are not present in the economy. So there are some supply factors to be addressed. But it's not a cost issue. I mean, I resent that to admit that, you know, all the problems of competitiveness of Cyprus would be solved if we just addressed cost. It's not primarily a cost issue. It's an issue of bringing in all types of necessary skills, so it has to do with training and education and structure and emphasizing quality. That's my personal view as a policy.
Can I just say that I think that also you have to be efficient as well, because you have a civil service that is totally inefficient. Most of them have two, three jobs in addition to what they do for the civil service. They are very well paid. They expect all these perks and everything, and they don't produce. You know, so that, I mean, but the proportion of the civil service in the Cyprus labour market is a big proportion. If you try to get them more efficient, if you reduce the cost, the private sector is definitely much harder work. They not get paid as much as a civil service, so you have to start somewhere.
I think, yeah, definitely we have to compete with regard to quality, but I think price competitiveness is also very important, and especially since we are trying to integrate with the rest of the world. The Cyprus is now a lot more open economy than it used to be. So we have to understand that we have to compete on price as well. It's not enough just on quality. And we've seen, I mean, Fiona was saying with regard, for example, the business sector, that we are already losing to other countries like Malta. And so it's very important to really maintain our competitiveness.
Do you want to say something?
Only that the process of bringing in quality and skills is a long-term process, and the crunch is very rapidly coming, I'm afraid. If you look at the numbers on the labour side and on the demographic side, and some of the things Fiona was saying about the business climate, there is a crunch coming, and it's coming sooner rather than later. Cyprus is going to be in the same position Greece was a few years ago. In a few years, if there are not major changes, and major changes very quickly.
I'm going to take a second round of questions in a minute, but I want to respond to the question to the Commonwealth and question on pensions, very briefly on pensions and retirement. Two parts of the question. The first one is what do they do after the age of 65 when they retire? Well, the answer is that they're abused by their children. They do all the childcare, they do the shopping for them, they do the cleaning, they look after the house when they go on holiday. Now that the birth rate is falling, maybe there will be some more available labour. But talk to Cypriot families and you see that. Now the other issue is why is the pension retirement age always withdrawn? Would the relevant union feels very strong about that, of course, in withdrawal. And then you might ask why. Now, one of the arguments that they bring, which seems to be persuading the MPs who have to vote on it, they always vote it down, is that there is this misconception in Cyprus, despite the many times that I said it in public speaking when they asked me that, that if you extend the retirement age, then you're going to create youth unemployment. And that's completely false. Completely. There's absolutely no evidence in economics that youth unemployment has any relation to the retirement age. I don't know. I puzzle as to why everyone has this this idea. I think I persuaded one influential person there, Mr. Averoff, if I can say his name, that is completely false. He went to support it when they were discussing the measures recently, and he was voted down. And I came to the conclusion that the only reason that they think like that is public sector recruitment, because the public sector will say, this year we have so many retirements, therefore we'll advertise so many job positions, and they apply and get it, because the mind of the Cypriot is entirely geared to the public sector, nice pension, and that's it. I agree entirely, but the main thing is that it's got nothing to do with the retirement age of old people. They're not substitutes in employment. Whichever way you say, no, we are concerned about youth, we don't want to cause youth unemployment, therefore we're not going to vote for an extension. Yeah. All right, we'll take another round of questions, Fiona.
Back to the COLA issue again. I agree that we do need to focus on quality, and that's the long term. But I think the market has spoken in terms of unemployment and in terms of increase in foreign labour, that those sectors that do have unionisation, like tourism, if you have an automatic increase in wages, it just creates unemployment in the long term for Cypriots. But there's another hidden cost to the wage indexation which no one has mentioned, and that is that if you're an employer and you have to give all of your workers the same increase every year, or twice a year, regardless of their performance, you don't have any other tools, especially as a small business, which is 96% of businesses. You have no other means to incentivise your staff, because you've got to give them all 3-4% depending on the oil price that year. How else do you incentivise them? And I think it's very damaging. So it doesn't incentivise you as an employer to incentivise your staff, and in turn, the staff have no reason to do better. And I think that's a hidden cost that I'm talking as someone who worked for 4.5 years for a private company that never paid me a single pay rise at all. But so there is a big chunk of the economy that doesn't actually is not affected by COLA in any sense whatsoever.
Thank you. Is there any other comment for you? Yeah, yeah. Okay, we'll do it in reverse. All right.
Hi, my name is Maria Patsalos. I'm an immigration solicitor at Mishcon Dorea. I don't know if this has been raised at all today, but I think one thing that Cyprus is missing a trick in relation to a potential economic citizenship programme. Lots of countries have it, including the UK, where you can invest 1 million, 5 million or 10 million, and that directly injects into the UK economy. And other smaller countries, such as St. Kitts and Nevis, small island in the Caribbean, have it as well. And I think it's something where Cyprus is really missing a trick, because lots of people, especially obviously lots of Russians are interested in Cyprus, but lots of people all over would be interested in Cyprus because of the access to, obviously, the EU. And are there any plans to think about this, or consider it? Because I think, especially with Cyprus being part of the EU, you could really up the value of these kind of programs to quite a significant amount.
Thank you. And there's one at the front here, and then we'll discuss.
This is more of a comment, but there is an aphorism that says, never waste a good crisis. And so far, my personal opinion is that the government is wasting this crisis, because a crisis is not just a threat, but an opportunity to change things. And a lot of the changes that have been introduced are short-term in nature, fixes, in the hope that the economy is going to recover in a year, that capital markets are going to open again in a year, and What I worried about is that even if we go through the short-term problem with the banks in half a year, come at the end of the year, we're still going to need financing, and we're not going to be able to get it from the capital markets, and then we're going to have to get deeper in debt to the Russians, to somebody else. And there is no clear signal from the government that we're taking long-term structural reforms that is going to change the perspective that the foreigners view us, the credit rating agencies, but not just them, international organizations and investors, that we're thinking about having a long-term vision that goes beyond the gas issue. So the hope, I think, is that we will just survive up until we get the gas going, and then that's it. I don't think that's a realistic vision.
Okay, who'd like to comment on this? Do you want?
Yes, on immigration, already there is a policy of, I don't remember the necessary amounts, of giving the opportunity to some non-Cypriots to acquire citizenship if they bring money into the country. But there's a process, I mean, Council of Ministers approval is also needed. I don't remember the amount that is... No, there is a criterion of bringing into the money into the country a certain amount of money, which I do not remember now. I mean, it's not it's another minister's competence, but this opportunity is there. I think the reason why I receive so much attack is that, yes, I'm not susceptible to any way of influence. but it's not. It's a different ministry which handles this, but this opportunity exists.
Economic immigration does have great virtues in terms of bringing new skills into an economy, but the Canadians have had a bad experience in a small percentage of cases where people have come, made their minimal investment, met the criteria, brought their family, granny, 12 kids, all their uncles and aunties, and then gone back to Hong Kong or to Pakistan and left them dependent upon the Canadian economy. This isn't the main case, but it is a problem with economic immigration that you somehow have to be able to address before embracing it too wholeheartedly.
That's why it doesn't happen a lot. I mean, I just responded that these cases have to be approved in the end by Council of Ministers. It's not, it's not the way out. It's there. And anyway, Cyprus is a small country with a population of less than 1 million. We already have a lot of foreign labor. So even in terms of social sustainability, you cannot work your way out by encouraging even more immigration.
Yeah.
Thank you. I would like to say that I totally agree with Mr. McDonald's opinion on sustainable growth when it comes to Cyprus and the need for a settlement to have a long-term growth prospect for the whole island. But knowing what's been going on for 40 years and, you know, having been acquainted with the false hope of reconciliation process, it could be logical to conclude that this process is likely to continue for a long time. And yet we're talking about, and the conference is titled, you know, Managing Reform and Sustainability, and when we're talking about sustainability, we have a long-term outlook. And in this picture of a long-term sustainability in island's economy, I'm curious to hear what the panel thinks as for the role Turkish Cypriots can play and what contribution Turkish Cypriots could have in managing the reform, providing new labor force, and sustaining a better economy for the whole island. Thank you.
Yeah, let's take it.
Hi, I'm Teresa Delgado from the Treasury. I have a question with respect to the tourism sector. I mean, they said that in order to be more cost-effective, they have been hiring more immigrants. And I wonder what is the framework that allows the immigrant to be like cheaper labor? Is it because they are less unionized, or is it because automatic wage increases are not applied to them,
And one more, sorry, we forgot about you.
Thanks. I want to make a bit more general point following the last point. In much of today's discussion, we seem to have referenced competitiveness as something which sort of, you know, outside society and it's always about sort of short-term solutions. It has to be price-related, and you know, indexation of wages means that the real wage does not change. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's a disproportionate increase in wages. You can see it as a problem that workers get too much, or you can see it as a problem that the economy does not produce enough productivity growth. Obviously, in the short run, it's easier to cut prices, wages, than to increase productivity, to do the structural changes. But, you know, we always live in the short run. So at some stage, you have to worry about how do I introduce the structural changes. If there's a crisis, you have to take the short-run measures, but there's not always a crisis. And so reflecting on the situation in Greece, I always thought, you know, countries like the UK and Cyprus and other places, Holland, they actually have a strategy and a plan, and they know what they're doing. And maybe that's why they're not getting into the troubles that Greece does, where everything's ad hoc and just happens, you know, incidentally. And I'm worried that, you know, this crisis, what seems to have done to Cyprus is that push towards ad hocery and sort of quick responses to problems. Maybe you can afford to have 9% unemployment for a couple of years. It's not the end of the world. Europe has had 9% unemployment, you know, for a couple of decades at least. And it has survived so far. So, you know, maybe it's not the time for the quick fixes. Maybe it is time to think, you know, maybe it's not the time to deregulate completely the labor market. It seems to have been working for a while quite okay. You know, maybe Fitch and Standard & Poor's are going to be relaxed in a couple of years and the economy is going to go back to stability. I can say that because I'm not running the economy and I have the luxury of being relaxed about it. But I think doing the opposite is also not necessarily the good thing.
We had three actually. Okay, very quick because we need to respond to long questions. Do you want to make one very last, very, very quick comment though, if you could?
The first one, it's on the COLA, because we referred to the wage indexation numerous times today. The Cyprus received a recommendation, and there has been the express commitment of the government towards at least the Commission and the other European partners that there will be a social dialogue and there will be delivered a reform in the first half of the year. I hope I'm still right about the...
Whatever has been agreed is being implemented.
Yeah, I think so.
No, that there will be negotiation in 2 years, within the next 2 years.
So within this year.
When the public sector unions agreed to the package, it was also understood that there would be discussion on reforming COLA.
Yeah.
Now, the worrying thing about this is that everybody seems to accept the idea that reform means making COLA more equitable. So COLA has become an instrument for reducing inequality and so forth. And that's why I phrased my remarks the way I did this morning, focusing on the proper function of COLA clauses, which is sort of risk sharing, either on a voluntary basis between employers and employees or through some sort of institutionalization, which is what we have. The concern now is that the latest agreement that the Minister of Labor worked out, which kind of preserves COLA in its current form, will derail the pledge that was made, which is what Bolivius is getting at. Now, I don't know what the sequel to this will be. That's where we stand.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll respond to do you want to respond to the first question about
Yes, it's just also, of course, if I could also make a comment on this cost of living allowance issue. You know, I have worked at the Central Bank of Cyprus for 24 years before going out and then becoming a minister. I have been participating in discussions in when IMF missions, credit rating agencies, and whomever were visiting. As of year one, when I was at the Central Bank, every time the IMF would be there, every time credit rating agencies would be there, the COLA issue would come up. And over these 24 years, the economy was growing. It was going. I mean, COLA had nothing to do. We had great growth, low public debt percentages, independent of COLA. So I would like to indicate that it could help, but it would not solve our problems, because the long-term history shows that independent of whether we had COLA or not, the economy would still follow the cycle of positive and less positive growth rates. There is a structural problem, I insist, that has to do with great dependence on imports of oil and energy does influence a lot cost of production in Cyprus and hence prices. And this is a major factor in determining price competitiveness in Cyprus. That's why I say once we manage to address this issue, competitiveness will vastly improve. And in many professions, though we say it's labor wages and the rest, in many professions already there are no Cypriots. And yes, wages of non-residents, Europeans mostly, are much lower. Not that there is discrimination, it's just that perhaps they are hired. We do need to implement these professional standards that are being developed in Europe and in a way make them obligatory if necessary, in the sense that in that way you can ensure that if somebody is hired and he's a doctor, he's hired as a doctor and not as a waiter, let's say. So concerning the this very nice issue about the role of the Turkish Cypriots, and of course the country can only have a future if all the Cypriots can live together and can contribute together to the future of the country. And Turkish Cypriots are residents, are citizens of the Republic of Cyprus, and they are entitled to all rights that Cypriot citizens have. Of course, already most Turkish Cypriots are working in the Cyprus economy, either north or south. I mean, there's free movement and so whoever was available is working, and we wish there could be more around. But it's not that either the Greek Cypriots or the Turkish Cypriots are in big numbers. And certainly, as I need to indicate again, that the current government is actively searching for a solution, an agreed solution between the two communities that would enable reunification, because it's only through reunification that we could have a sustainable future in the country and in the area. So, and as a leader of a small political party, which is very pro-solution, we do receive every day the cries of our Turkish Cypriot compatriots that they are becoming a minority in the north, and so that we have to act quickly so that the Turkish Cypriots do not vanish, and eventually the Greek Cypriots, i.e. all of the Cypriots, will then become a minority in Cyprus. So time is not working in our favor. This is why we consider, and the President has been calling out, that now Turkey also has an additional incentive to contribute to the solution of the Cyprus problem by contributing to the attainment of an agreed solution on the agreed framework of the bizonal bicommunal federation, so that both the Cypriots, all the Cypriots can have a future, and Turkey can also have a future of peaceful cooperation in the area. And what better situation could we have for Turkey if in the coming Cyprus presidency of the European Union, Cyprus problem would have already been solved, and Cyprus, the presidency of the European Union, would be the best and more active promoter of EU accession of Turkey. We should see how to turn around the situation and make it a win-win situation for everybody, rather than try to prevent good things happening. The opportunity lies ahead, and we all have to contribute to turning the picture into the positive outcome that it can take to benefit all of us. Thank you.
I would also, though, add that the reality is totally different. Reality is that Turkey is riding high. Turkey, it's up in the clouds looking down. They don't need the EU anymore, unfortunately, because of the way they are and the economic mess that the EU is. So, there is no incentive for Turkey now to compromise. And not only that, because of now they're playing this intra-regional kind of moderating power with the Syrians, etc., they are taking even more of importance in their own mind. So, unfortunately, it's not really to their advantage right now because nobody can control them. And in fact, there are a lot of press coverage recently that politicians are saying to them, or at least the press coverage indicates that somebody should really have a chat with Turkey and the president to make sure that they see reality, because they're really uncontrollable. Unfortunately, that's where we are. Would love to have the agreement, but don't think they want an agreement, unfortunately.
Only politicians, I'm sorry, would always target positive outcomes. And our intention is to target positive outcomes, and we are hopeful that all possible participants in this equation will respond constructively to the opportunity that lies ahead. And this is the message that the government of Cyprus is sending out. And as a minister of this government, I'm sending this message out on behalf of the government and of the president, that an opportunity lies ahead of us for all the Cypriots, for Turkey to contribute to the resolution of the problems of the past, so that we can all move ahead in cooperation, in peaceful cooperation, so that we can capitalize on the opportunities of the future.
Good. Thank you. Kate, do you want to make any final remarks?
Just one point that we should not be contented and say, oh, there is no need to make the reforms right now, we can't wait, because there is nothing wrong with having an unemployment of 9% for a few years. I think there is a need to press on with reforms, be those in the labor market or in the welfare system, because we don't want to repeat the mistakes of other European countries, including Greece, where they just did not implement the reforms at the right time. So there is some urgency with regard to that.
I sincerely hope that the other 12 blocks will produce more reserves and that you're going to have something that can be brought onshore, because we've been talking about funds and what we do with funds, but first you have to realise the assets from that gas. And how are you going to do that without pipelines here and pipelines there and LNG terminals, et cetera, et cetera? And for the first time in the last 40 years, Cyprus now has a bargaining chip in its hand vis-a-vis Turkey. It has the potential of gas, and the Turks understand money. And you can pay off the value of the Cypriot gas for major political concessions if there's some blue sky thinking. And that would allow people to start thinking holistically about Cyprus, preserving the Karpis, getting rid of Varosha, knocking it down, starting all over again, putting a big tourist infrastructure in the north, an industrial infrastructure in the south, gas, fertilizer, plastics, synthetic fibers, etc. You would have a viable Cyprus, and you would have something that Turkey would understand.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, everyone, on the panel. We've exceeded our time, but it was a good discussion, so we have no regrets. Kevin would like to say a farewell.
I think what I've learned today is more confusion, really. And let me say, I think we've had the most high quality of panels to finish off to add to my confusion. I will go away and sit on the train this evening and mull over different alternatives for Cyprus. I think I'm going to be thoroughly informed of at least seven different scenarios for the future of this country. I want to, which is my way of emphasizing, actually, that I think it's been a very good day's conference. We've had the most informed of discussions and very good questions from the audience. It's been very focused, very detailed, good research presentations, etc. So first of all, I'd like to thank each of the contributors to the various panels and the discussions. If I could say in particular, of course, our guest of honour, the Minister, and also could we give a special thanks to our Nobel Laureate member of the audience as well and team as well. Finally, not quite finally, of course, we should thank everybody who's contributed to the organisation, everybody who has contributed as sponsors. We have Deloitte's Ethniki Chabza, we have Marfin Bank, the Jean Monnet programme for the Commission. It's made it all feasible. Finally, there may not be a free lunch, but there is indeed a reward now we finish. Downstairs on the fifth floor in the senior common room, there's a reception where we can meet and talk, and you can confuse me even more. But finally, can we thank everyone involved, and especially our speakers today. Thank you very much indeed.